The following is a presentation of the Six Arrows Radio Network.
Today on The Workbench, all about HF power amplifiers with David Schoaf from Elecraft. Stay tuned. Welcome to The Workbench. I'm your host, George, KJ6VU.
And I'm Jeremy, KF7IJZ.
This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Elecraft, makers of high-performance radios, amplifiers, and other great station accessories. Check them out at www.elecraft.com. And by Autodesk, the makers of Eagle PCB design tools, the software we use to design all of our Workbench build projects. For more info and your free copy of Eagle, go to www.autodesk.com/eagle today. Before we start the show, recently we announced the winner of the 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel. So far, our friends at PowerFilm have not been able to contact that winner, so we're going to draw a new winner. Here is Seth Hansen from PowerFilm to announce the new winner. Seth, welcome back to the Workbench Podcast.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And the last time we talked about the 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel giveaway, we had a winner, and that winner is Jim. And as of now, Jim has not responded.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't hear from him inside of a time window that we stated, so we have another winner.
Yeah, it's too bad for Jim. Sorry that that didn't work out, but who's the new lucky winner?
The winner is David Homan. David, I will I'll reach out to you via email as well with the email that you opted in with. But congratulations. Once I get into contact with you, we can get you that panel as soon as possible.
Okay, David, so you really need to respond because you don't want to be in the same boat that poor Jim was in.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully. And then another little piece of news, but we are going to extend this promotion that we talked about last time, 10% off of this item. Until Christmas. So, yeah, we just wanted to open it up and keep it open as long as possible for people to buy the panel for themselves as a gift, whatever they see fit.
Oh, that's great. So why don't you tell us one more time exactly what that product is?
Absolutely. So it's the 30-watt foldable, and it is includes an Anderson Power Pole connector because we understand that Anderson Power Pole is nearly ubiquitous amongst the ham community. And our panels feature a Delphi WeatherPak, which is a great connector, but it actually is an automotive connector. We use it because it's watertight, but Anderson PowerPole makes more sense for ham radio operators. So it will come with that cable. And the claim code, again, is ham radio, one word, capital H, capital R. And you can save 10% off of that item. It's fulfilled through Amazon.
How would they find the product?
Yeah, the easiest way is to go to our website. It's www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench. And so you'll just see a link there you can click, and the item is on Amazon. So fulfillment will be through Amazon.
And how long is that special deal going to be available to listeners?
Yeah, so that's going until Christmas Day. We wanted to leave it as open as long as possible, so people will have more than enough time, if they so choose, to visit and make that purchase.
So on the last show, I mentioned that I thought that the 30-watt panel would be like the perfect stocking stuffer for Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of... it's the sweet spot for us. It's a very lightweight panel. It's about a pound and a half. So very lightweight, but it's, you know, it's getting up there in the wattage area where you can do some serious charging. So you can obviously power a small QRP rig. You can direct charge cell phones very quickly with the proper adapters. But yeah, I mean, once you get 30 watts and above, that's a decent amount of power that you can use, but in a very lightweight package.
And with that panel, if you had good sun, what's the voltage and the current max that you could expect to get out of that?
I believe it is 1.8 amps and that is in full sun. No, absolutely. Yeah, it adds very minimal weight to your pack, to your setup, and that's huge depending on where you are. So yeah, I think it's a wonderful panel. It's a good kind of introduction into our technology. So I hope some of your listeners take advantage.
Well, hey, thanks so much. We really appreciate you doing that for our listeners, and I'm sure they appreciate it too.
Thank you, George.
Welcome to the Ham Radio 360 Workbench, your bi-weekly deep dive into making and DIY and technical topics of interest to the amateur radio operator. Back again with George. George, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jeremy. How are you?
I am fantastic. And tonight we have a very special treat for our listeners.
We do indeed. Tell us about it.
Well, tonight we are joined by David Cho from Elecraft.
Hello, David.
Hey, good evening. Good evening. How you doing? It's evening as we record this, I guess, so that's good enough.
Yes, and tonight we will be doing a deep dive on RF amplifiers.
So, David, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? So you're with Elecraft, and yes. Just tell us a bit about what you do there.
Yeah. Well, first off, I've been at Elecraft for about 5 years or so, like a number of the engineering and technical staff. I spent all my life in the tech business. I'm one of the Silicon Valley renegades, so to speak. I worked for Hewlett-Packard for just over 20 years, and then prior to that, about 8-10 years with Texas Instruments. And prior to that, during college, I even worked on the bench and stereo world, the audio world as well. So I've been at the electronics business for quite some time, and I've got one son. I'm married, live here close to the plant here in Watsonville, California, and have two grandchildren as well. So very fortunate to have had a wonderful career, and now I get a second career with Elecraft. Just best way to go.
So what do you do for those guys?
Okay, so I actually, like many folks in a company like Elecraft, I wear multiple hats. So first off, I handle all of the international distribution for Elecraft. Believe me, learning about how ham radio is done and regulated in other parts of the world is quite an experience in and of itself. So I work with a number of distributors in Europe, Brazil, Japan, in order to get our products into those parts of the world. And it's not an insignificant amount of the business that Elecraft does is overseas. We sell and support all of our products directly out of California, even overseas. So it's good to have good relationships there. So that's one thing. The second thing is I also, all of the customer support folks report to me. So anybody that's contacted Elecraft for support purposes, all those guys, hardworking, work for me, and can't say enough wonderful things about them.
So you get exposed to every aspect of the product line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of my job is to make sure that when it hits the streets, that it's ready for prime time and that we can also support it remotely.
So, so before we jump into the amplifier topic, so since you are responsible for the international distribution, are there differences in that worldwide? I mean, when you think about selling ham radios in the U.S. versus selling and supporting them in Europe or Asia, is it kind of all the same, or are there regional differences?
Oh, there are regional differences. Things like band allocations. So, do you know how many different 60-meter band allocations there are? Is something on the order of like 30 or 40. In other words, depending on different countries, even inside places like the European Union, every country still gets to determine what their actual allocations are and what your limits there are for. In other words, the transmit limits, the upper and lower bounds that we always worry about on every band, those vary from country to country. Also, there are regulatory issues, like in Japan, where you have to you license your radio as well as the operator.
So, interesting. Mm-hmm. So I bet like working DXCC on 60 meters must be a real pain, because you may not be able to find enough countries with the same frequency allocation.
That's exactly right. That there are overlaps. There's a lot of overlaps. But what you find is that the band edges differ from country to country. Now, for us, what that means is we have to have our radios set up. It's sometimes in some countries different from others. So, for instance, in Japan, you don't get to operate on 60 meters at all. And you have to be able to prove to their equivalent of the FCC that your radio will not transmit on 60 meters.
Oh, wow. So even in some regions, like in Europe, my understanding is that the 60-meter channelization is even different between countries in that same region, which that, must be ridiculous because they're all so close to each other.
That is correct. However, they have a band that we don't have. You can get on to 4 meters, not 2 meters, four meters in Europe, in parts of Europe, but not all parts of Europe.
And that's around 70 megahertz?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so if you look in our product line here at Elecraft, you'll see that for the KX3, there is a 4 meter module, which is no one in the United States would be interested in. But in Europe, they're actually we're one of the few radios that supports 4 meters.
I'll be darned. So that's interesting. So
see what I mean about the international part.
yeah, very interesting, actually. Yeah, very educational. Tell us a little bit about your ham background.
Actually, that's the interesting part. My original career goals were actually to end up at the Voice of America. I grew up about 40 miles from one of the Voice of America sites. So as a kid of the Cold War in the 60s, that was my idea of the great place to go. So I went to engineering school thinking I would go to enter into the broadcast industry. Part of that was to get my commercial radio telephone license. You had to have that in those days to be able to work at a TV station or radio station or whatever. So I went through the analog world of engineering for an RF. I had trouble with the Morse code. I lived in a small town. I didn't have a mentor or an Elmer to help me. And so I never got my commercial. I got my commercial ticket, but never got my amateur ticket until 1999 or so. So it's only been in the last 15, 17 years that I actually got my, extra class license.
Okay, so you were ham for about a dozen years before you came on board at Elecraft.
Oh yeah, oh absolutely.
So what attracted you to go to Elecraft?
Let me give you a little bit of inside scoop here. At Elecraft, it's like having a ham club meeting every day. In other words, most of the guys that work there are members of the local clubs here in the Monterey Bay area. And so we all knew each other long before we ever went to work there. And working there is very much very collegial, very, like I said, we knew each other anyway. And so it's just feels like a ham club meeting every day at Elecraft. We all have our customers' interests. We're looking to produce new, way cool new products all the time. And so that's kind of the way it works. And it's a wonderful place from that standpoint. By the way, we do factory tours if anybody wants to come down.
Well, at this rate, you're going to get inundated with applications for employment. <so. laughs>
Well, that's okay. We're always looking for excellent, excellent people to help us build radios. That's never a problem.
And if you're going to say free beer on Fridays, then, man, you'd be inundated.
Oh, yeah. That's sort of like the old Hewlett-Packard days of the beer bust on Friday.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us a little bit about what you like to do besides ham radio.
Ah, yeah. Well, that's part of the challenge. If you build ham radios, you have to remember I get paid to blow up radios every day, right? So, I mean, I'm joking about that, but we do work real hard. And so the last thing sometimes you want to do is to come home and then look at the same radio yet again. You already did it 40 to 60 hours a week. I do other things. I actually play in bands. I play saxophone. So I play in a swing dance band, old school jazz, as well as I play in a saxophone quartet. And so that keeps the other side of my brain busy. I got the techie side, then I got the other artsy side. And the other thing I like to do is, believe it or not, is restore old tube audio tube amps, and you know, hack. So if you ask me what I have on my bench, it's probably going to be some audio gear, usually dinking around with single-ended MOSFETs and things like that. And
So, no amps with a pair of 6146s in the final.
Oh, I've done that. I've done some of those sorts of things. Although that's kind of kind of getting out. It's harder to find those 6146s.
So I have to tell you a little side story. So I was in Japan on a business trip, and so I go to this enormous camera store, which is, I mean, one floor is cameras and electronics on everything else. And I went into the high-end hi-fi department, which of course has a bunch of tubes. And mm-hmm. and so there's a big glass case with boxes of tubes, and I'm kind of curious, and I take a look in there, and all of the tubes are things like 6146s, 12BY7s. I mean, there are like all these tubes that were drivers and finals in ham radio gear. And
absolutely.
So I guess that they have a long life in the hi-fi world now.
Absolutely. We can thank the vintage guitar amp guys for keeping those tubes alive for us too. Those are the ones, that's where the big draw is.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun too. But it's nice to be able to balance your lifestyle here a little bit as well. So can't do hobby, ham radio 100% of the time. But boy, I do a lot of it every day, even on the weekends.
So last question about your workbench. So you said mm-hmm. you've got some sort of audio project. Could you tell us about what that is?
Yeah, the current one right now is it's actually related a little bit to Elecraft. The gentleman who designed our speaker, that's the SP3, it's for our K-line, that's K3S and KPA 500 and 1500 and all that, is actually he's a PhD acoustics guy. He's a double E as well, but an absolutely wonderful gentleman, and I hope at some point you'll get him on your show. His name is Bruce Edgar, E-D-G-A-R, and he actually has designed a set of horns. He's retired now. I have the very last set of horns that he built. These are huge floor-standing horns. The subwoofer is about 6.5 feet tall.
Wow.
So they're high efficiency, and so they can be run with the audio equivalent of a QRP rig.
Okay. So is that the new Elecraft SP4 you're just previewing for us?
No, not at all. No, believe me, if for anyone who hasn't heard our SP3, I highly recommend that you come to one of the booths or give us a call, and we can tell you a little bit more about it. It was actually designed for the Contester and DXer because it is very low distortion. And it's unlike any other communication speaker you've ever heard. And you can have one or two of them on your K3 or K3S. It's very nice. I actually have hooked it up to my single-ended audio stuff and used them as well. They're very, very high fidelity.
Well, I'm glad to hear that those are good speakers because I have a pair of them on the station here.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to convince myself why I spent that much money on two speakers. And so you're making me feel better.
Oh, yeah. Hook them up to your stereo. You'll be pleasantly surprised what you'll get out of them. So that's kind of what I do. This coming weekend, there's a really interesting place. This is something for your folks to look up. Look up Burning Amp. Burning as in fire. Burning Amp, A-M-P. It's a bunch of audio do-it-yourselfers that like to hack in the audio world. And they have a get together every year. It's been running for 10 years up in San Francisco, and I'll be heading to that on Sunday.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. I bet there's some hams up there besides yourself too.
There certainly are. There's a lot of crossover guys like that there. Me is one of them.
So Jeremy,
I'm sitting here laughing because I've mentioned in a previous show that I had a little bit of the audiophile bug throughout my life. And of course, I knew that I was never going to put the financial resources behind it that a lot of folks do. But listening to you talk about a set of horns, when I was first starting out, the dream was going to some estate sale or somebody's grandmother's house and finding a set of original Klipshorns sitting in the in the corner that nobody knew what they were, and nobody wanted furniture-sized speakers. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a kit made by a company up in the Puget Sound area called Bottlehead, and they specialized in, or rather, they specialize in single-ended triode tube amp designs. And I have their their kit called the Single-Ended Experimenter Kit, which is run by a pair of 6DN7s, which are double-ended triodes. Dual triode tubes that were originally designed for television rendering. So they only output 2 watts max, and so high efficiency speakers are really critical, although they actually do a fairly, as I understand, good job of, I've got a set of Klipsch floor standers that are 97 dB efficient, and for filling a room without being overpowering, that's two watts is plenty of power. And it's funny, if you spend any time in this world, everybody always says the first watt is the most important.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly right. Yep. And it's actually, that actually in some ways applies to ham radio as well.
Yeah, that sounds like some QRP mantra.
Yep, it is. It certainly is.
You know, and this is funny, because this is actually now taking me back to my days in high school. I remember, you know, when the folks that I knew who were starting to get into putting, you know, big stereos in their cars, and it's like, oh, I've got, you know, 100 watts. Oh, I've got 500 watts. And my friend's dad, Keith, who at the time was KA4ROS, which him and his son Alex are the reason that I even knew about ham radio. But that's when I first learned that, you know, doubling your power only increases output by 3 dB.
Yes, indeed. The laws of diminishing returns kick in quickly.
Yes. I wish that were on my workbench, but that project is still downstairs. So, George, I'm just going to be honest, I might have one day between now and the end of the year that I'm going to get to mess with stuff. And I really hope that I'm going to be able to continue work on my 3D printer. Because as a coworker pointed out to me, a box of 3D printer parts does not a printer make on its own. So, but there is one thing I definitely want to share with folks, because this is a day that I've been waiting for and I'm super excited about. So last episode, I kind of talked in depth about the forthcoming AirSpy HF Plus software-defined receiver. And Yusuf posted today that pre-orders have started for the HF Plus. And as a reminder, this is a DC to approximately 260 megahertz software-defined radio receiver. It is a device that runs over USB. It has a VHF port and an HF port. And it is designed for ridiculous sensitivity. And a lot of work has been done on gain, and of course the AirSpy SDR Sharp software is wonderful for receiving, and then to me the killer app is his work on the SPI server remote monitoring capability and all the efficiency he has built in, both from a spectrum rendering perspective as well as audio decoding. But these are now available for pre-order. Our partner here in the United States, and definitely good friend of the show, we talked about Joe quite a bit because he hooked us up at Dayton and kept us out of the mudslide. But airspy.us, if you go to airspy.us and go under products, there is a main nav entry for the pre-order of the HF Plus. It will be available for $199. And what's sad is that there were some pretty nice discount coupons available, both for the US and the European folks who are ordering. But I checked before this because I was going to share the code with people. There was a limited number. They're gone. So, and it was a pretty generous number of coupon codes they had activated. So response for the pre-orders has definitely been, I would say, very positive. So another thing is that I have one of these on the way to me, and I can't wait to get it. Right now, the only thing I can really connect it to is I've got a, you know, 37-foot random wire upstairs with a 9-to-1 Balun for it. And as soon as I get that, I can't wait to report back about it. But because of this, I have started researching HF loop receiving antennas. Do either of you have any experience with receiving loops?
Yeah, a little bit.
No, I don't at all.
Well, so the only loop experience that I've ever had is there's, you know, of course, I at one time owned the Alex Loop. In fact, actually, I had it, and it paired quite nicely with my KX3. But the, you know, the when it comes to the receiving side, I hadn't really ever conceived of it. And the machine overall looks a lot simpler. I guess the physics work a lot better for a relatively smaller loop, because these things are only about 3 feet in diameter, and they generally have an active HF preamp on them. But there's no adjusting. It's not like tuning the way that you tune for a you know, for a transmitting antenna. So David, what do you know about these things?
Yeah, I work with a number of folks who are using them now. I've gotten, of course, I get to play with a lot of stuff, and I've played with the Alex Loop, among others. The proper technical term there is dinking, D-I-N-K-I-N-G. That's a technical term. And so I've dinked with a lot of these, but I also have some experience working with customers. There's some things you have to think about with magnetic loops. The good news is, for portable use, they're actually very good. Why? Because they are generally self-supporting. One of the big challenges you have when you go portable, of course, is do you have something to hang a wire in? So if you're up on the top of a bald mountain, that's not going to work very well. And Alex loops, as well as things like buddy poles, are self-supporting. And that makes a lot of sense. And so the nice thing about a magnetic loop is, when you're in its sweet spot, and there is a sweet spot, so what you do when you tune it, it is awesome. It is got, you can hear, it is incredibly sensitive. The bad news is that as soon as you dial off the up or down the band, you have to stop and retune your magnetic loop. It is a very high gain in a very narrow bandwidth. So there's a trade-off.
Yeah, then that was definitely my experience with the Alex Loop, especially the lower in band you get, the narrower the bandwidth of the antenna.
You got it.
You know, and for the antennas that you can tune, you get fantastic rejection, you know, mm-hmm. for being able to really null out the things that aren't in the bandpass that you want to receive. And mm-hmm. the other thing that's nice about these is they're directional. You can rotate this antenna. And as I understand it, the directionality is off of the same plane as the loop itself. So the circle, mm-hmm. if you were facing the circle, you would be in the null. If you're looking at the antenna so that it virtually disappears into a thin strip, you would be in the lobes.
Absolutely.
You know, go ahead.
There's another aspect. We're thinking about the use of a magnetic loop for transmit as well as receive. That's when you're using the same antenna for both. We have a lot of guys who are beginning to use, magnetic loops and loop antennas of various kinds for a separate receive antenna. A lot of the Elecraft radios, the K3 and the K3S, support a separate receive antenna input from the main transmit antenna.
And that's actually exactly the purpose that I'm looking to find a receiving loop mm-hmm. antenna mm-hmm. for. Because mm-hmm. like I said, these antennas, they have an HF, you know, preamplifier on them, but there's not a tuning module for them per se. One of the most popular... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, go ahead, because I was going to talk about a downside.
Well, I very much want this feedback. So mm-hmm. a lot of folks who are using the AirSpies and other similar dongles, and then also I found from folks who do a lot of like shortwave listening, one of the more popular receiving loop antennas is from a company in the UK called Wellbrook. They have about 10 different models of varying quality of construction materials, like some that are more rugged than others, some that are made out of plastic. And then some of them have more and more, you know, advanced preamp designs. And I think you get started for about £240, which nets out to about $320 US dollars plus shipping or customs or whatever. Mm-hmm. I haven't really shipped anything from the UK, but one time in my life. And then I see that there is at least one in my 5 minutes of Googling on this, looking for a domestic alternative. I see DX Engineering offers one called the RF Pro 1B, and it would set you back for approximately $500. And, you know, it's everything that you need except for a rotator if you want a rotator.
Are those broadband, or is there some remote tuning thing for it?
It has to be broadband because neither one of these antennas have any type of control whatsoever. It's just a preamp. And this is where my understanding, antennas are voodoo and magic to begin with. Loop antennas, magnetic loop antennas, doubly so. And so I can't speak expertly at all on this and why that is. So, Dave, what's the downside?
Okay, so when we're talking about using them as a receive-only antenna, one of the things you have to think about is its co-location to your transmitter antenna. So that is, if there is sufficient RF coupling between the transmitting, let's say you're transmitting, that receiving antenna doesn't necessarily know that you're transmitting. It's going to be receiving, right? It's going to be generating a small voltage that comes down the line and into your radio's receive-only antenna input. Now, on the K3 and the K3S, we have what's called a carrier-operated relay. That's shortened to COR. And this feature actually is a sensor that measures the amount of incoming power from the receive antenna. And if it's too high before it starts damaging the radio, the radio will actually assert automatically its attenuator.
Ah, so it takes itself out of the circuit for all purposes.
Well, yeah. Now, ideally, what you want to do is to find a receive antenna that has a way to be able to tie it into your radio so that when you go into transmit, it effectively shorts the output of the receive antenna while you're transmitting. That way, you don't run the risk of burning up the input on your transceiver.
You know, I would think actually, it's so funny that you make the comment about shorting the antenna, because in my mind, you know, just instinctively, I'm like, oh, well, take that out of the circuit. But you're right. If you just close across it, then
It's easy.
Yeah, it's super easy. Yeah. And I bet you that it would not, especially with all of the radios that have, CAT and serial data out, I would think it would actually be relatively easy to, you know, respond to a key up event by, basically, like you said, shorting the receive port.
Yeah. Yeah. There are actually some third party boxes. I think DX Engineering has one. And, by the way, I can make an announcement here. DX Engineering is now going to be reselling Elecraft's test equipment line of products. I bet you didn't even know we had a test equipment line, did you?
Well, we kind of did. Now, it depends on what you're talking about, because George and I have talked in the past about things like your tone generator, and some of the
two-tone generator.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And some of the other, you have an RF signal source.
We have a couple of them, yeah.
Yep.
We have two.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we have talked about those before.
Cool. Yeah, well, DX Engineering will now, in about a month or so, however long. We actually just signed the papers today.
So that's literally breaking news.
Breaking news, you got
it. So if on some Friday afternoon, I've got to get my XG3 for the weekend, I can call them up and it'll be there the next day.
That's right. That's the plan.
Very cool. So, by the way, you guys don't distribute in the United States except direct from the factory, right?
That is correct.
All regular products.
It's more than just North America. It's South America. It's most of Asia, with the exception of Japan. Outside of Europe, Japan, and Brazil, we sell and support directly from the factory in California. Mm. Parts, support, remote support, phone calls, you name it. We do it.
So, well, congratulations on the new thing with DX. That's great.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But back to the loop. I think DX Engineering is making a cute little doodad, but I can't remember the model on it, that effectively allows you to connect up to your there's usually a keying line on the back of most transceivers that changes states when you go into transmit. It's the way we'll be talking about that on the linears as well.
You know, and actually, so while you were talking, I pulled up the instructions for the DX Engineering model. And so they have a box that is, it's basically the power supply for the low noise preamplifier that is up actually at the loop. And there is a line off of this that has, so it has... It can, one side connects to the keying line or an amplifier keying line from your radio, and then it has a pass through onto your amplifier. So this actually is already built to take itself, you know, out of commission. It looks like that's a terrible way of putting it. It looks like it's designed to protect itself.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
In fact, actually, they're saying that they built it to withstand up to 30 dBm of RF without failure. And that they tested it with
serious.
Yeah. And they said they tested it with a 1500 watt transmit, with a quarter wave vertical transmitting antenna. It was found that the worst case loop output power into the preamp was 10 dBm when the antenna was 25 feet from a vertical radiator and adjusted for maximum coupling. So, that they say 20 dB safety margin. So, that's actually nice that, you know, and this is what I would expect from DX Engineering, right? The Wellbrook antennas, you know, are designed specifically as receiving antennas. And, you know, whereas DX Engineering is doing this because, like you said, a lot of hams are, may have an array of receiving antennas of different kinds. You know, and George, this actually reminds me of getting back to your friend who was using a remote monitoring station and transmitting from home, because another benefit of loop antennas is because they respond to the magnetic part of the electromagnetic wave, you get a lot of less electronic interference.
Oh, that's a good point. I should try that sometime. I have an Alex loop, and I should try that noise wise compared to the vertical. We just did our antenna shootout comparing the Pactenna and a buddy pole and a loop, Alex loop and all that stuff. But we're mostly looking at transmission performance and really not looking at noise. So that's an interesting idea.
You know, I'll share with you what is a fun project. And of course, this is something that, that I don't know if it'll ever be available, but when, Alex was at, Dayton and has been for several years, but, when I talked to him, I think 2 or 3 years ago, one of the things that he had there was a prototype of a Bluetooth controlled remote tuning app. So they had put a little, drive motor or servo or something in the, you know, on the tuning knob, put in a little Bluetooth, and microcontroller. And then he had an app on his phone that he could actually adjust the tuning. And, we talked about, is this ever going to be available for sale? And he's like, well, we're kind of playing with it, working with it. But as a project, this is actually something that if somebody wanted to, they could start off by making a remote tuning control fairly easily. And the way you tune these manually is you tune it for maximum noise, right? So as you start rotating the dial, you're going to tune it to where you can hear the maximum amount of noise, then you'll fine tune it from there. But there's, you know, technically no reason at all that you could not use some combination of sampling the audio output of the radio and, you know, CAT information to understand where the radio's tuned, to set up tuning algorithms nearly automatically. I know I have seen projects of people automatically tuning loop antennas.
Yeah, it sounds like Arduino stuff to me.
Well, by the way, we could use those microbits. Remember the microbit on the link dipole?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Project. We could do the same thing, but instead of just switching the relay to switch the segments in and out, you could have it drive a little H bridge to control a motor, and just have it swizzle the capacitor back and forth and just tune by ear even.
So a swizzle, another official tech term like dink.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it dinks swizzle a lot.
Yeah, okay. So, not quite on my workbench yet. Like I said, I don't know when I will receive my HF Plus, but I am super excited to get it up and running. And then actually, you know, as I mentioned last time, these things are being put online on the internet. I think, you know, hopefully around the holidays, I'm going to go through the trouble of punching the hole in my firewall out to the internet and making my my Air Spies available to connect to for other, you know, for other folks. And I'll when I do that, I, of course, will announce it on the show.
When you do that, let me know and I'll figure out how to set mine up over here.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be neat. I just have a little USB. You can do that with the USB one, can't you?
Yeah, you can do it with, again, the magic's all in the software. And the software supports, you know, now all three AirSpy devices. It supports the RTL SDR dongles. And I think it'll do HackRF1. I can't remember. But yeah, no, absolutely you can do it. Right now, my unit upstairs has an AirSpy Mini, which is what you have, and also an AirSpy R2. The AirSpy R2 is, you know, currently connected to the SpyVerter to give me HF connectivity, and the other one is connected to one of the Diamond miniature disk cones, which gives you approximately 100 megahertz to like 1.6 gigahertz.
DC to daylight.
Yeah, that's the goal. Because if I can't talk, I at least want to be able to listen. So yeah, that's what's on my workbench. George, what about you?
Well, I actually, as a follow-up from last week, we talked a bit about the workbench build projects, and I made some progress on two of them in the last couple weeks. The 4-port remotely controlled antenna switching relay board, I need a pithier name for it. That final design is done. I've sent the very last, latest, updated final version off to the PC board company, and I would expect to get boards back in a week or two. And if they check out and work okay, then we're going to make kits available. I posted on the Facebook page a little bit about it and just did a quick poll and said how many people would be interested in such a thing. And I think I got about 25 plus, 30 plus responses, and about 2/3 plus of the people that responded said that they would like to get a full kit. So since that was the majority vote, we'll figure out if we could do that. So circuit board, programmed processor, all the connectors and other discrete parts and all that. So David, what this thing is, it's a circuit board about 6 inches on a side with 5 right angle B and C connectors along the back and 4 latching relays. And it's essentially a single pole, 4 position coaxial switch implemented with relays. Mm-hmm. And you could either manually select which port you want by pressing a button on the board, which is only for convenience because this will probably be put somewhere you don't see it, but you could hook up push buttons to it to select one of 4, or you could hook it up through a USB cable to your computer to control it with software, or you could put a little 2 gigahertz data radio, a little XB radio on the board, and you could put this thing, you know, across your property and yes, remotely switch. So you could either use it to switch 4 antennas to 1 radio or 4 radios to 1 antenna or whatever you like.
It's just like those old coaxial switches we've been using for years, right?
You know, yeah, exactly. Except you don't have to grab the knob.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You know, you had mentioned that you were going to have Barrick, or you did have Barrick sweep that.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was one of the questions I kind of poked at you last time is the, you know, we have established that this thing is 100% good to go for HF. What about VHF and UHF?
So the last version that we did, he ran the board through on the vector network analyzer and the performance at, let's see, up to 50 megahertz was perfectly fine. Just what you'd expect. And then at 2 meters, it was not quite as good as I would have liked. So I went back and moved a few things around on the board, which I think will make a little bit of a difference. So I think from a practical point of view, it would work fine on 2 meters. There might be just a little bit of insertion loss, but I think we're looking at, you know, less than a half a dB. So it'd be like putting an adapter on the cable. So I don't think it'll be all that bad. So if you're just hooking it up to your radio, talking to a repeater, for instance, you'd never notice. It would work perfectly fine. If you're really doing weak signal stuff, then you're every tenth of a dB matters. So maybe not perfect for that. But the one of the changes to the final layout was to move some of the traces around to optimize the layout, given the kind of parts we're using. We could use a much fancier impedance-controlled high-frequency relays, but it would jack up the cost of it significantly. So for HF, there's no point in doing that. If we were to build it for VHF, then we'd take a different approach. But it's really intended for like HF and maybe six. But, you know, in a pinch, you can run it on two.
Now, out of curiosity, I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I was going to say just kind of an interesting comment. The Cat 500 tuner we have from Elecraft actually uses washing machine relays for 500 watts. And they actually work very well all the way up through 6 meters.
Yeah, we're probably using the same thing, actually.
Yeah. And they're tough as nails, and we've had absolutely no problem with them. We, for the, past 5 years or so, we've had that guy out. The other thing you might want to look at on the Cat 500 is the way we go about providing capabilities for you to declare whenever you switch bands. The tuner, of course, it's got its own frequency counter. You can tell it what preferences of antennas. So, for instance, if I've got three ports on it, if I have two antennas that would operate, for instance, on 20 meters, which one do I want it to always go back to whenever I QSY to 20 meters? So I have two options. Either I could say, I definitely want I want to go back to my beam every time first, and then I'll switch to a dipole if I have one. Or I can say, remember the last antenna I was on this band and switch to that.
That's a good idea.
Programming capabilities that you've got, you're setting yourself up to be able to control.
You know, you mentioned something that really piqued my interest here. So there's no band decoding on this thing. There's a serial port for control. So if you could, so you can tell it whichever relay you want to engage. Let's say you could snoop the serial control line on the back of the K3 or the KX3, and then just take the band data and select, you have a little table and select whichever antenna is right for the band you're on. So you could definitely add like a band decoding function to this.
We actually already have that. We also make a product called the KRC2. I call it it's just like the Play-Doh of ham radio. It will actually decode anything. If you want BCD band data, or if you have a Kenwood and you want to listen to the RS-232 COM port, it'll actually decode all that and then throw a signal that you can then connect up to. It's open source or open drain on each signal, and it does all that work for you. And it's a little kit. We've had it in the product line for almost 10 years.
Oh, that's cool. So it's essentially a band decoder, or it's even more than that.
It's a band decoder that you get to map what you want it to do. There's an application that you download as well, and it's essentially the front end to the circuit board you're building.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take a look at that. If there's a way to sort of easily connect it, then we'll see if we could do that. That's a great idea.
Yep.
So that's kind of project one that's pretty close to being done. And project two is the power gate. And I get a lot of emails, Jeremy, about the power gate. So, David, this is kind of like a West Mountain power gate. It's a DC power control circuit that takes two 12-volt inputs. Whichever one is the higher of the two input voltages, it'll gate that path onward. It goes through a Hall effect current sensor, so you can measure the current and the voltage. And there's a microcontroller on board that monitors the battery voltage. And if it goes above or below a particular voltage, then it opens the circuit. So there's a latching relay on the power control side. Yeah. So that thing, the final version is done. I had to come up with a footprint of a part. I couldn't find a pre-existing library component anywhere, so I had to build the footprint. So no big deal, but it's kind of this weird MOSFET. So it's a power MOSFET, and it's like an SO8 package. So it's a small 8-pin surface mount package, but it's a proprietary high power version. So there's all of the, it's not like gull wing pins. It's got little bumps underneath it at the edge of the package. So it's kind of an odd transistor, but anyway, so I had to relay out the board to accommodate this crazy transistor, but it was worth it because that particular transistor has about a 2.7 milliohm on resistance. So you can handle high current. So there's a whole long and sorted tale that I won't bore you with, and the listeners might remember it, but the prototype of this thing, I picked two P-channel MOSFETs, and when I looked at the specs, they were 75 milliohms on resistance. And I thought, wow, that sounds low. So I bought them and I built it. And after about an amp and a half, they got hotter than heck. And I thought, well, how could that be? And I mentioned it to a friend of mine and he said, do the math. And I went back and calculated it. And well, the reason why you could fry an egg in this thing is because 75 milliohms at, you know, amps is, it's going to be hot.
Yeah.
So, okay, fine. And so I happened to be talking to a fella that has a little business, and he makes these boards. And so I emailed him and I said, hey, I made a thing that's kind of like the thing that you sell, and it's hotter than heck. And he said, oh yeah, you don't know what you're doing. You need to use a transistor with a like a 2 milliohm on resistance. And he was so nice. And this is a fellow from a company called Flint Hills Research, maybe. And anyway, we'll post this in the show notes. But he was super helpful, and especially since we're making like a build project that's like something he makes as a commercial product. He was so generous with his time to explain why I was doing the wrong thing. Anyway, so now I've got the right part in there, and I'm hopefully going to get the boards back in a few weeks, and that thing will work. So the whole goal here is to have both of those boards in some small quantity ready to go well before Christmas, so people can have them as stocking stuffers. So there we go, Jeremy. That's what's on the bench.
You know, what I'm learning from all this is that when your kids are grown and out of the house and pretty much out of college, you get time back.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
That's why they can charge $50,000 a year for college, because you look at it and think, yeah, that's a good trade-off.
Yeah. Yeah. I've only got, 20 years to go, 20 plus. That's okay. So my goal is to try to get the kids addicted to what I like along the way.
Yeah. That's good luck with that.
Hey, it's working with it's working with Minecraft and Legos so far. So,
well, that's a good start. So, by the way, I just happen to remember that the fella's name is Jim, Jim Cordell, who owns Flint.
It's Flint, Flint Hills Radio.
Flint Hills Radio. Yes. So if you need to have a power gate now and you want to go buy one, go buy Jim's. If you want to build one, stay tuned.
Yeah. And of course, ours is more than just a power gate, right? It has monitoring and also the low voltage disconnect.
Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, ours is this design a little bit more all-in-one than just the gating capability. And so, yeah, look for more information about that. Like we've said in the past also, we have a pretty good plan for re-ramping up a host of new projects and offering them to our listeners for sale coming in 2018. One of the things, if you don't know, Elecraft actually has been publishing a newsletter this year called QSO News from the World of Elecraft. And this is, it has several functions. And number one, there's a lot of good educational material in there. There's interesting things about some de-expeditions. It's also a great way to find out what the current specials and discounts that Elecraft is offering. But this one that just hit a couple days ago, which conveniently is written by our guest, happens to be all about amplifiers.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. So when we come back from the break, we are going to start deep diving with David. Well, that's alliteration. We are going to deep dive with David about amplifiers for your HF radio and all the various kinds, the considerations, the technologies, the approaches, the care and feeding. And then we'll also talk a little bit more about the specifics of the options offered by our friends at Elecraft. So hang around.
Elecraft is one of my top picks for high-performance HF radios. They make fantastic base station-style radios, amplifiers, pan adapters, and other station accessories. They're also the designers of the KX3 and KX2, the ultimate portable HF radios. If you're thinking about SOTA, portable operating, or travel, you really need to be looking at Elecraft. Elecraft has some of the best designs in the industry, compact, high-performance, feature-rich designs. You're really going to love them. The KX2 is my personal favorite for going portable. It's ultra-small, 80 through 10 meters, sideband CW and data modes, and the thing runs 10 watts on the internal batteries. You'll love it. Check it out at elecraft.com.
So, David, I had the good fortune of seeing a recording of a talk that you gave at HamCon this year around the time of the introduction of the KPA 1500. And you gave a lot of good information on that, and that was recorded by Ham Radio 2.0, which I'll include a link to that talk in the show notes.
Certainly.
And, you know, you spent a lot of time talking about, amplifiers and use in de-expeditions and gave a lot of good tidbits about Elecraft amps in general. But for somebody like me, in the grand scheme of things, I'm a relatively young ham. I know folks do have amps. I know that they help people be heard more or better. But it's something that I really haven't necessarily given a lot of thought to, because I'm in a position where I can't even put up an antenna outside. And so having an amp in my current house is probably not something that's going to happen. But why don't you just, let's start off with, what is an HF amplifier?
Well, an amp is pretty much anything that'll take an input and make it bigger on the output, right? At the end of the day, that's what amplifiers do. We have them in our cars. We have them in our homes. You know, they're everywhere. Audio, there's RF amplifiers. And their job is essentially just to make a signal larger. When it comes to ham operating, what we're dealing with is making a radio frequency signal sufficiently large, because there are easily calculated mechanisms. It's a laws of diminishing returns. In other words, it's an exponential kind of calculation for how much further or how much louder I might be heard by some station if I go from 100 watts, say, to our legal limit here in the U.S., which is 1,500 watts.
So is there a short and easily demonstrable way that you could describe, you know, we talked about you have one input and then something comes out bigger on the other end. Do you have a quick way of explaining at a high level how that actually works?
Yeah. All engineering tends to refer to things in a relative term of measured in usually dB. And in fact, let me kind of give you a little tidbit here. In the United States, all linear manufacturers for RF radio, particularly ham radio, are limited to a gain of 15 dB. And that means that there's only so much power that I can allow the amplifier to create based on its input. That limits the gain, that we measure it in terms of gain. And let me give you an example. If I have a 100 watt linear, and we actually have one, that's the KXPA 100, 5 watts in will give me 100 watts out. So that linears, that the linear part means that if I go down to 4 watts, that means I'm going to get 80 watts out. If I go down to 3 watts, I'll get 60 watts out. See, so it's a linear. In other words, the amplifier doesn't change its gain characteristic just because I lower the input case. The challenge is that in the United States, I cannot take my 5-watt QRP radio and get 1,500 watts out of a single box of an amplifier.
Okay.
Okay.
And just, you know, for to kind of walk us through it, you know, we've talked about dBm, which is, like you said, a common measurement of relative signal. You know, we've talked about watts, you know, talking about going back to my earlier days. I remember one of the first lessons I learned long before I even dreamed of being a ham in talking about audio. You know, people would brag about how big their stereo was. And, yep. You know, and from basically going from, say, 50 watts to 100 watts, you are doubling the power, but it's only an increase of 3 dB. So can you kind of walk us through the, in an easy to understand way, if that's possible, you know, how you go from 5 and then 15 dB means you're at 100?
Yeah, you can actually, there's a number of online calculators for you if you really want to get right down to the numbers to actually do that. So let's step through it this way. In other words, let's talk about power. Let's talk about the cost of these amplifiers, because this is really where this gets interesting. So a 100 watt linear from Elecraft is $750. That's the KXPA 100. It'll take me from 5 watts to 100 watts, and I go from 100 watts to 500 watts. A KPA 500 is about $2,300 today. But now if I go to a 1,500 watt amplifier from a 500 watt, that's $59.95 from Elecraft. So there's a dollar laws of diminishing returns, as well as the amount of signal increase that I'm actually presenting out to someone who's listening to me.
Okay, and a walk through that. So for the KPA 500, if I double that to 1,000 watts, that's 3 dB, and then get up another 500 is about, what, another 1.5 dB?
That's it. That's why we use the dB mechanism as a way of calculating that.
Yeah, so it's 4.5 more dB out for more than twice more the price.
Bingo, bingo. There's your laws of diminishing returns. For everyone, there are a number of considerations. And by the way, the November newsletter has a nice article that I wrote about what are some of those considerations. Just because you can go to 1,500 watts doesn't mean that if you're living on a small postage stamp, or if you're living in an apartment or a condo, that doesn't mean you're going to be able to actually get 1,500 watts out before you start impacting other things in your residence, like ground fault interrupters and things like that.
Well, you know, that's a good segue to the, you know, at the end of the day, we're kind of answering the reason I want one is to be heard better or to be louder. You know, in my case, I own a KPA 100 for my Elecraft KX3. And that's so, honestly, my biggest use for it was to be able to take my KX3 to field day and run it as a, you know, a 100 watt radio. You know, but honestly, most of the time when I run it, I only, if I'm running in the field and I'm running off battery and solar, which is how I commonly do it, I'm only going to run at 50 watts, which is only a 3 dB lower signal, but it is also a lot more power efficient.
Yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And you're drawing substantially less current off that battery. You're going to get a lot more time operating in the field if you back that off. There's one other consideration, too, on when we're talking about battery operation. I'm going to just kind of jump over to that. And this has to do with those amplifiers, those linears that operate on 12 or 13.5 volts, like your KXPA 100. One of the things that all manufacturers do, it's not just Elecraft, is they specify their transceiver to operate with a DC input voltage of 13.5 or 6, usually about 13.5 volts. And that means under load. So if you're running 100 watts, they'll specify that 100 watts, but only if your power supply can handle 13.5 volts under load. Now, you're going to be pulling about 20 amps at 100 watts out off of that battery or the power supply that you use in your shack.
Yep, and this I was going to say, and this is you know, something we've talked about a lot, and this is why it's critical to use the heaviest gauge cabling you can from the battery to whatever you're running, because you, you know, we don't think about it very often in low current applications, but that power wire is a long resistor.
It certainly is, and we use a 12 gauge wire on our new KPA 1500. We have the power supply separated. We're using 6 gauge wire on that critter for the between the power supply and the RF deck.
Well, so what are the type of, I guess, operating modes besides being louder? You know, what are the types of things that folks are going to go out and purchase one of these, you know, amps that will take me beyond 100 watts for the common radio that I have in my shack?
Well, what do you mean by, I'm not sure what you mean by modes. Can you be a little more specific?
Well, I guess the reasons that people would do it, you know, and in my mind, it even breaks down from folks, you know, wanting more power at home, but then also, and this was an aspect that I had never really thought of before, but your talk about de-expeditions and whatnot. So, you know, kind of what role does an amplifier play in a ham's life based on what the kind of type of operating they do?
Yeah. One of the traps we tend to fall into with linears. In the article in our November newsletter, I actually start out talking about there was a really funny movie back in the 80s called This Is Spinal Tap, and there's a really funny scene where this guy's playing this mockumentary about a band called Spinal Tap. And the guy says, oh, no, my amplifier is really nice. I can turn it up to 11 instead of just 10. And we have this trap in where we want to compensate maybe for maybe not the best antenna or other reasons. And all you don't want to do is just apply more power, right? Which is roughly like turbocharging your Pinto. You know, if you don't have a great antenna work system to begin with, just pumping more power into it is not necessarily going to buy you the desired results. So this desire to want to turn it up to 11 is kind of a motivation, but it feels like a motivation. But if you look at back up and look at the whole system, you may not need to either buy a legal limit amplifier. Maybe 500 watts is all you really need. And so there's some considerations about physical size, where your shack's located, where your antennas are located relative to where your shack is. In other words, if you've got a antenna right outside the window in your shack, cranking up the power is pretty much going to guarantee you're going to get RFI back into the shack, right? So why would I go to 1500 watts?
I gotcha.
So when we're talking about motivations for why we want a linear, we have to be pragmatic about that and be sure that we're buying one for the right reasons. And you'll notice that a lot of de-expeditions will only take maybe a 500 watt amp instead of a full legal limit. And there's a number of reasons why they have to take generators a lot of times, and a 1500 watt amplifier is going to take 220 volts AC. It's going to have a lot of different requirements, whereas 500 watts, you can actually run that on 120 or 220. That's kind of the kick point where you have to choose where you're going to have to pull maybe a 220 volt line into your shack. It's going to cost you extra money.
Gotcha.
Hey, David, I've got a question for you, if I may.
Yeah.
So since we're in this kind of bad part of the sunspot cycle, do you see people buying amplifiers now because they're trying to overcome poor propagation conditions?
Oh, that would be a reasonable rationalization for buying one.
I'm always looking for one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but the other thing you could say is, we'll go up and put more metal in the air, raise up your antenna if you can do it, add more ground radials, get a better launch pad. There's all kinds of other things you can do besides just turning it up to 11 with more power, right? I mean, we all went through that I used to install disco systems in the 70s, so kind of gave you while I was in engineering school. And I learned very quickly, just adding more power would only turn more heat into and burn up more speakers. Well, whoop-de-doo on that. And same question here. If you're still running RG8 cable out to your antenna, I'm not sure you really want to crank up the power and just arc it over, right? It's not interesting.
So the first lesson, and I know we'll cover this in depth, is that an amplifier is part of a system. It's not just a standalone thing, you know, and you're really, you're really driving home that between considering how you're going to actually give electricity to the thing, to how your grounding is set up, to what type of coax you're using, all of those things really start to come in. Well, and for that matter, even what antenna you're connecting to it.
Yes.
So, yes. I mean, by and large, you know, obviously Elecraft has a few products in this line. What are kind of the common, I guess, power levels? I mean, it seems like there are amps designed for QRP, which we kind of covered. Then you said 500 watts is kind of a sweet spot. And then obviously legal limit is 1500.
Yes, that's legal limit in the United States. Finish the sentence. Remember that in some parts of the world, they are already limited to 400 or 500 watts.
Is there anywhere that's limited or that is either unlimited or gets more than 1500?
Technically, no. Other parts of the world, however, you will find, let's just say, used AM transmitters being used in ways they probably shouldn't, at least in the ham world. But that's a different, they're different jurisdictions, and we won't go there. That's in the United States, we have a good regulatory system that allows us to be very clear with all of Elecraft's customers and how we will go about doing what we do. That limit of the 15 dB gain, which, by the way, just as a kind of an aside, do you know how we ended up with that?
No.
Yeah. Okay. So back in the mid-70s, there was a big citizens band craze. It was built around Smokey and the Bandit. It was a movie and all kinds of stuff, a truckers movies. There's all kinds of crazy things. And the problem was, is we had abuse happening on 11 meters. And in the mid, the FCC went to the vendors of many of those 11 meter amplifiers and said, you guys are going to have to cut this off. And you're going to have to put controls in your linears. And so for anybody who's gotten one of the old Ameritron amps or some of those older amps where you had to go get a 10-meter mod, that was actually where that came from. It was a FCC regulation. And today, here we are, what, 40, 50 years later, that baggage, that restriction of that 15 dB of limit of gain and lockout on 11 meters still is on the books. And so any U.S. vendor making and selling linears is directly related to the imposition of those regulations based in the mid-70s. That 15 dB gain is directly related. Right now, there's a petition afoot with the FCC to remove that. And in fact, if you buy linears from overseas and think you're bringing them in here, which we don't recommend that you do, you will find that the 15 dB limit that we just talked about is not imposed in those amplifiers. However, you should not be using one over the 15 dB gain if you're in the United States.
Gotcha. So, kind of to this point, when the KX3 first came out, you know, when it was announced there, it was announced that, hey, later on, we're going to launch, a dedicated 100 watt amp for this radio.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are there any problems with running, say, a KX3 into a KPA 100 watt amp and then running the 100 watt amp into one of these linears?
Certainly. There's no problem at all. That's called cascading, and you can do that all day long. So for instance, let me give you an example. So let's take our KX3. It's right now you can do up to 15 watts out on between 80 and 20, and otherwise it's 10 watts out. And if you hook that, you can hook that directly up to a KXPA 100 and get 100 watts out. Now you can also connect a KX3 up to a KPA 1500. Excuse me. Let's deal with the 500 first. So you can go KX3 directly connected to a KPA 500, and at about 15 watts out, you're going to get about 240, 250 watts out. You can drive it directly, but you will not drive it to complete output. In other words, it can't drive it to 500, but I can get pretty close. I can get halfway there. I can connect a KX3 directly up to a KPA 1500, and I'm going to get something on the order of about 500 or 600 watts out. Now, if I go back, though, and take my KX3 and then connect it to a KXPA 100, and then connect the KXPA 100 to a KPA 500. Now I'm cascading linears, and I can do that. Then what's going to happen is that the KX3 is going to be, let me do the math. It, when you're driving it, KXPA 100, the KXPA 100 will take about 20 watts to drive the KPA 500 to full output, 20 to 25 watts, depending on the band. Or I can, and if in which case the KX3 at 20 watts out, it's only doing about 2 watts, the actual KX3, which is driving the KXPA 100 at 20 watts out into the KPA 500 at 500 watts out. Does that make sense?
Yes. So, you know, we talk about this, and of course we're fairly familiar with you know, some of the things that the Elecraft has done, and there are a lot of amplifiers available on the market, and I know your guys' mm-hmm. amplifiers are all solid state.
Yes, and they're diode switched. There's no, we don't use relays switching between transmit and receive. That means we can go lightning fast.
Gotcha. So, I mean, over, you know, generally speaking, like, what are the different, I guess I'll call it engineering topologies of HF amps out there?
You mean between like tubes and solid state, or are we talking about the connection technologies about how we interface them?
Let's start with tubes and solid state, because later on we'll ask a question about the, you know, does this work by I simply just plug my radio into it and it goes. Okay. So yeah, let's start with tubes versus solid state, which is, of course, if you have an audio background, this is a favorite topic.
Well, of course, in the early days, pretty much anything up until our solid state devices finally got stabilized enough, we always lived with tubes. And even today, you can still buy tube amplifiers. Now, the thing about a tube amplifier is that from an operating standpoint, tube amplifiers have been around. The circuit topologies, the design topologies are all well engineered, well understood, and well known, and there's no surprises there. And but the all of them share one common operating characteristic in that when you go to a different band, you are going to have to change what's known as the tank circuit. It's the matching circuit between the transmitter and your antenna transmission line system. And that's what those big knobs on the most linears with tubes in them will do. Well, the problem with that, from a if I'm a contester, this is not interesting. Why? Because I'm going to be moving around fast, because contesters measure their success on the number of cues per minute or per hour, or however they want to measure, but it's volume, right? It's sheer. I got to move, get the contact, move on to the next one. That's all what we hear every weekend on the contest. The problem with tube amplifiers is I can't waste any time stopping and retuning my tank circuits on my linear every time I change frequencies far enough out. It's very painful. For the guys who just want to sit and rag chew, probably not a big a deal. But for the radio sport guys, this is not interesting. Well, the nice thing about solid state amps is that once you've switched to a band, there are none of these fine tuning things that I have to do anymore once I've gotten to the band, and so solid state amps are they've done a couple of things for us. First off, they've given us the ability to switch bands quickly and stay there without having to do a lot of tweaking and dinking, right? Go back to our term that we talked about earlier. But the other thing that solid state amps have allowed us to do is to physically remove and reduce the size of the cabinets. Most tube amps are big. They generate up a Jesus amount of heat, and they're hard to operate. And so you get the old guys will say, well, that's what I grew up with, and that's fine. But the solid state amps allow us now, our Q counts, average contest Q counts, D-Expedition Q counts, have you seen how those gone through the roof? If you look over the last 20 years and see how many Qs that these guys are doing on a weekend basis for contesters or whatever, the numbers have gone way up. Well, part of that is because we've taken a lot of the operating things we had to do just to move around a band. We've removed them with solid state amps. They're in our transceivers today. When we change bands, I don't have to remember to tune the finals like I did on my Kenwood, TS-520? You remember the old...
That was my first brand new radio.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get the idea.
So I get a question, though, about tubes versus solid state. So back then in the TS-520 era, and we're talking the mid to late 70s now, was kind of the end of the tube finals, and we started to see solid state finals in the next generation of radio, and that's about when we started to see solid state amplifiers. And the rap against solid state way back then was that they were delicate. In other words, you could abuse a tube amplifier. If you had a lousy SWR on your tube amplifier, those tubes could take it for the most part. But if you had a high SWR and a solid state amplifier, there's a good chance you'd lose your finals. And in fact, the first solid state radio I played with was an ICOM, 701, I think is the model. And those things were notorious for popping finals because they didn't have very good output protection circuitry. So could you comment on how that's changed?
Mm-hmm, sure can. One of the really nice things is that the solid state state of the art has really improved, and particularly in the last 20 years. So for instance, most of the new linears you see today are going to be built with what are called LDMOS devices. These are MOSFETs, essentially. In the old days, we were trying to use bipolar transistors. And frankly, they were not stable from 160 even to 10 meters. Now we see most linears today, solid state, are all the way out to 6 meters. I've got guys running right, KPA 500s running in moon bounce at 6 meters. You know, and they'll do it all day long too. You couldn't do that in the time period you're describing. So what we've seen is the devices themselves are more linear across a wider bandwidth. That makes it more easy for the designers like Elecraft to use them and to reduce the support circuitry. That means we reduce parts count, which means we're reducing cost as well.
That and means, probably improving the reliability to boot.
Absolutely. Now, there's a trade-off. You were talking about the whole issue of, tube amplifiers are more tolerant. Well, yeah, they are. It's because you're tuning them and maximizing the match between the antenna transmission lines. So if you think about, if you could imagine looking down into your transmission line, whatever's connected to the other end is what an amplifier sees. And you were matching that every time you were moving around your bands with a tube amplifier. So you didn't really need much of a tuner. Whereas on a solid state amp, and even today, most solid state amps, once you get about 1.8 to 1 SWR or higher, solid state amps don't really like you anymore. They will, and if we were talking about instrumenting amplifiers, you know, and building in instrumentation so that amplifiers can keep track of what's going on and actually take action on it, this is a good example of where that happens. So in 1.8 or higher, our recommendation is for solid state amps is that you have a tuner downstream.
And with the Elecraft amps, are there tuners built in, or are those external devices?
Well, we actually do it both ways. It depends on which one we're talking about. So, for instance, and there's a chart, by the way, in the November newsletter where I kind of outline all these characteristics. In the 100 watt amp, you have the option of installing a tuner inside the cabinet of the 100 watt amp. It can or cannot be there. It's either way you want to do it. So, for instance, if I was using something like a step IR or maybe a mag loop, which is already pre-resonated, I don't need a tuner because it's going to be below 1.8 to 1. I should have set it up that way. Whereas, that's the 100 watt amp. The 500 watt amp, what we did there was we made the tuner into a physically separate cabinet. We call it the KAT 500 or just CAT 500 for short. And so the KPA and CAT 500 linear and it's a companion tuner, while they're physically in separate boxes, once you've optimized them to operate, they're like they're connected together inside. So we did that at the 500 watt level. Now, when we came out with the 1500 watt amp, it's still solid state. We're not using any tubes. And there, though, we have one problem that we need to deal with, and it's a safety issue. When we are thinking about the reflected power, because remember when I send a signal down, the reflected power is the how I calculate my SWR ratio, that 1.8 to 1 or whatever. When I start looking at more than about 1.5 to 1, the potential reflected power, depending on where, can be quite high in terms of voltage. It's a dangerous voltage. And so in the KPA 1500, we have a built-in tuner in it at 1500 watts, and we do not allow you to buy it without the tuner. It is built in and will always be in. Now, you can bypass it, but you cannot buy a KPA 1500 legal limit amplifier from Elecraft without the tuner, because that tuner is going to help absorb some of that reflected power. That's what tuners do.
So
does that make sense?
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so as we go up in power, there is a risk, because now I can have arcing because of very high voltages, standing waves out there on in my transmission system.
So one thing that you're talking about that makes the solid state amplifier more robust is having the tuner, so that the amplifier final transistors don't see a bad match.
That's correct. I'm always protecting them. Yeah.
Are there techniques that are used? There are some amplifiers I've seen where when the reflected power goes high, the amplifier will fold back the output power to reduce the amount of energy. Is that a technique that's normally used too?
That's been a very common technique. If you're overdriving, ALC is another one. If you're driving too hard, you can set up a automatic level control between the transceiver and the linear itself. The problem you have with that is that's sort of like closing the gate after the horses leave. You know, and so we don't recommend it. ALC was also used because some of the early transceivers had another problem called overshoot. That was, as soon as you key the transmitter, the resulting RF signal coming out would be very large, and then it would back down to whatever power level you had set. And we call it spiking. And the good news is Elecraft transceivers don't do this, because we actually control the gain of the transmitter inside the transceiver, as well as the audio drive or the drive itself. Ours do not spike for that reason, but others do.
So you see on the meter of the radio, the ALC setting for the meter, and it's not really obvious what ALC does. So I understand what the word means, but could you describe what is ALC and when does it actually factor into how you set up your station?
Yeah, let's talk. There's actually two types of ALCs you just mentioned there. The one we were talking about is it's a feedback loop, but it's essentially a conversation that the linear and the transceiver can have. And it's RF-based because it's the signal that's coming out of the transceiver driving the linear, and then the linear being able to provide a way to say, wait a minute, you're giving me too much, back off. That's different from the fullback, which is on the output side of the linear.
Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt real quick. I apologize. Okay. Mm-hmm. For those of us playing along at home, can you guys define what ALC is?
That was actually my question.
Okay.
Thanks for asking it again.
The acronym. Definition of the acronym is automatic level control. Okay. There is a third ALC, and you will see this particularly in Elecraft gear, and that is an ALC metering that you'll find on the front. And we were always taught in the early, when I'm setting my audio drive, if I'm on sideband, that I want to increase the audio drive of my microphone until I just see the onset of ALC. And it's usually provided as a meter on the front of the transceiver. That's a different ALC, because that's the drive into the transceiver's transmitter. That's different from the ALC conversation we were just talking about between the transmitter and the linear. Okay?
Okay. Because a lot of times when you see ALC come up when you're setting things like the level for a digital mode interface. So that's, I'm running PSK audio 31. Drive. Yeah, it's like an audio ALC.
That's correct. That's the audio drive into the transceiver from either a mic or a sound card.
Yeah. So this is where ALC gets kind of confusing, because I think that the generic term is used a couple different ways.
That's exactly what your challenge is. That's why I had to stop and try to define exactly what are we talking about here.
Yeah. And
do you mean ALC or do you mean ALC?
For ALC.
Thank you
for clarifying that.
Yeah. You put apostrophe in a different spot on the acronym there or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So. So I'm bring me back to where we were, because I think we've gotten off a little rat hole here.
Okay, so I guess I've got a couple of other very practical, simple questions about looking at going to an amplifier. So we kind of talked about how big an amplifier would be, you know, in terms of how much gain, power output, and tubes and transistors. So if I'm going to buy my first amplifier, what other thoughts are there? And the kind of things that are swirling in my head are things like, how much power do I need, like 120, or do I need to pull in 240 volts? How do I handle grounding? Those kind of things. Yeah. So what's sort of the checklist of things that you need to think about if you're setting up your first amplifier?
Yeah, good, really good question. So the first one is, at some point, as we think somewhere between 100 watts and 1500 watts, there's a point at which I'm going to be forced into 220. In other words, if I have a small shack, a lot of us have really, you know, maybe a corner of an office or something like that, and the ability to pull 200, maybe I don't even have any more breakers space in my load panel in my house. So I'm going to either be forced into living at 120 volts somewhere, and or I'm sitting out in the garage, and the main power entrance to the house is right there, right beside my desk. Well, that's going to be easy, and I can get 220 pretty easily if I go that route. So one of the considerations and limitations is, can I even get 220 at all? Well, then the question becomes, okay, if I'm limited to 120, what's the maximum power I should probably ever expect to be able to get? And the answer is, it's somewhere between 500 and 600 watts. If we do the math on how much power is it going to take to get 1500 watts out at a typical efficiency of the linear, the break point is somewhere around 500 watts. So if you look at our KPA 500, when you buy a KPA 500 from Elcraft, we ask you a question: which power cable do you want? And that's based on, I need a 220 or I need a 120 cable. And we actually put one of those in the box and ship it after you tell us.
So at 120 volts, how much current do you need to run a full 500 watts out?
Ah, cool question. So at 120, for 500 watts out, at 120 volts, it's going to be at full. If you're running a fully resonant antenna at 500 watts out, it's going to draw somewhere around 9 AC amps. Okay. So if your typical drop, you know, if you look around your house there, those outlets that you got, those are typically a 15 amp drop. So now we're looking at two thirds of a 15 amp drop. That means if I have a dedicated 15 amp circuit for my shack, I'm going to consume almost two thirds of it at max out with my linear.
And you have to be careful. There's not six other outlets all on that same circuit.
You got to know. Have you got a refrigerator on the other side of the wall?
Yeah, you're not putting a Christmas tree in your shack if that's the case.
Right. That's right. And so that's one of the considerations then is, okay, well, what happens if I pull 220 into the shack and run that KPA 500? Now I'm down to about half that, about four and a half to 5 amps.
And the current for a typical 240 circuit that's pulled in, what's the typical service max current? Is that about 20 amps?
It's 15 or 20. Typically, that's not uncommon. Most of your electricians will give you a 20. And that the calculation there is, how far is this thing from the load panel? because there's resistance in the AC wire too. And so the NEMA codes, and actually I give you a link for the National Electric Manufacturers Association, all that's pretty much is the way we specify the kind of plugs that you get in the walls there. They've got all the calculations for and your local codes, your local electrical codes, and your local electricians, if they're licensed, should know how to calculate all of the gauge sizes needed to for the runs that you actually have during your installation. But these are important things if we're dealing with a 1500 watt amp, right? You're going to have to have all this stuff. It's not just buying the amp. If you got to pull 220, you're talking about some bucks. Especially if you've got to, hammer through your concrete floor, something like that. So does that help a little bit about why that's important? And it's part of the buyer's guide.
Yeah, very much so. Maybe the general rule of thumb would be if at all possible, this is my take on it. If at all possible, regardless of a 500 watt amp or more, if you could pull a 220 circuit, you should do it.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then the 500 watt class of amplifier would be reasonable to put on a 120 drop. But you have to be careful. You have to make sure that the distance from the panel is not too great and you don't have too much other stuff on that circuit.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Generally, the other 5 or 6 amps before you hit that 15 amp version, if you do buy like an Astron 35 amp power supply, it'll probably power most of your shack. You'll still be in a good safe zone with a single 15 amp drop.
You know, this just made me realize something that is kind of unspoken. And you don't talk about it too awful much, but what this basically means is that your average HF amp is approximately 50% efficient.
That's exactly right. And that's pretty common across the industry, too. That's not just any one vendor. That's very common.
Now, I would assume, and this could be a bad assumption, but I'm assuming that efficiency, power efficiency, is higher in a solid state amp than a tube amp.
Yes, but it's still around 50%.
Gotcha. And either way, you don't have to have a separate space heater in your shack.
No. That's the nice part. And you don't have a lot of high voltage tubes. You're dealing with lots of high voltage in the tube amps. We don't have to worry about that. For instance, the KPA 1500, we're dealing with a 50 volt input. So the KPA 1500, by the way, we have a nice FAQ about the KPA 1500 out on our website. And it's two physically separate cabinets. One's the power supply. The other one is what we call the RF deck itself. That's where the control system is, and the actual amplifier is there. And we have this big honking Anderson power pole cable set that's got 6-gauge wire that connects two of them together. And it runs at 50 volts. We couldn't do that if we had built a tube amp. You're talking thousands of volts. And you can't do that in an umbilical cord without making it absolutely unwieldy.
That also sounds terrifying.
yes, it does.
Well, and by the way, this also maybe indirectly points out that you really can't run your 500-watt amplifier off of a 12-volt battery.
You could, but if you do the math, you're talking hundreds of amps at 12 volts.
A lot of 12-volt batteries.
Yeah.
So is the actual voltage input to the amplifier chassis is 50 volts. It's not like 13.8.
That's exactly right.
I mean, you'd have to have like double, triple, zero size cable if you're running 12 volts.
It's already quite large as it is, even at 50 volts. Yes.
I mean, I will point out, George, and I'm not suggesting anybody do this, but getting a 48 volt solar setup is actually that's a very common as far as at least the solar going into whatever your installation is, but. This really goes back to the, okay, fine. If you're at home and you have wall power, you're good. But, you mentioned folks taking these things on de-expeditions, and obviously the big ones, you're looking at definitely gen sets for 220s, but Is it pretty much all of these amplifiers are exclusively run off of generators?
Yeah, that's a consideration because in order to make the cabinet smaller, and that is a trend that we are seeing in the last 10 to 20 years, is the physical size of a linear is getting smaller. And the issue there is that power-wise, it's easier for de-expeditions. Smaller is better, particularly for transport and weight, of course. The thing, though, is that at 1,500 watts, it's only been recently that the switching supply technology has been able to be brought to bear. And that affects how they work with generators. Switching supplies and generators have not gone, they don't play well together, have not traditionally. They're getting better at that now because of the switching supplies technologies have been greatly improved in the last 10 years. Ask anybody that runs a data center and they'll tell you that. And so what we're seeing as a trend is that for 1,500 watt linears, we're seeing more switching supplies. And in fact, the KPA 1500 has a switching supply built into it, whereas the KPA 500 has an analog supply. The majority of the weight of a KPA 500 is a honkin' big donut transformer that is fully analog, and the entire power supply, the filtering, regulation, everything is all analog.
Well, that surprises me. I would have guessed it was a switching supply.
Well, it's interesting. Let me give you a contrast. The KPA 1500, first, in terms of sheer cabinet weight, the KPA 1500 is only 4 pounds heavier than the KPA 500. One has the switching supply at 1,500 watts. The KPA 500 has an analog supply. It's got a great big toroid donut in there that's sheer mass. Now, why would we do that? Well, and it goes back to how the KPA 500 has earned a reputation for being absolutely bulletproof. And one of the reasons is that it can tolerate an incredible amount of voltage variation. Mm. If you go to third world countries, if you go to you go out to a deserted island and run radios and amplifiers on generators for a few hundred thousand QSOs, and then come home and declare victory, there has to be a way to do that. And analog supplies are far more tolerant of AC input voltage variations than the traditional switching supply. Like I said, switching supplies are getting better at that. But our judgment when we came out with the KPA 1500 some 5-6 years ago is that it's going to be an analog supply. And that has proven to be a very good solution for that. And it has earned a reputation. We're now we have to continue now with the KPA 1500. It's great. It's a great challenge.
So probably when you looked at designing the power supply for the 1500, if you went with that kind of rugged, analog, reliable kind of power supply, it would probably be massive and weigh a ton.
That's exactly right. And so that's the trade-off.
That's probably the reason why you guys decided to go with a switcher.
Yep, and it's physically smaller, so we could actually make the power supply cabinet the physical same exact physical dimensions as the RF deck. We could not have done that if we had tried to do it with an analog supply.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about voltage requirements. What about is there any other environmental consideration? We talked about tubes. You know, just sitting there with the filaments on, the tubes are going to be warm. Et cetera. So for the solid state amps, is there a consideration for ventilation?
Yes, there is. Yeah. As I mentioned, you know, we're seeing smaller cabinets. You still have power that has to be dissipated and moved out of a cabinet. I don't care if it's a big cabinet, small cabinet. And tubes, of course, just generated a lot. They were inefficient because the filaments sucked so much power. And, you know, generate a lot of heat, you have to get rid of that. On solid state, the issue is when I'm transmitting in a small cabinet, I still need to move a lot of air, right? Mm-hmm. The smaller the cabinet means I got to move that much more air through the cabinet to dissipate the heat. Well, now with with moving more air, you're going to use fans. That means the fans are going to generate more noise, right? It's a yes. relationship there, right? So if you look at the KPA 1500, it's in a nice, cozy, cute little cabinet. It's not much bigger than the KPA 500, quite frankly. But on the back, there are three fans, not one. There's only one fan on the KPA 500. So how do we mitigate that noise? Because you're going to probably have that RF deck pretty close to your operating position. And you can hear guys even on the air today where you can hear, as soon as they key up, you can hear their fans whirring in the background. Mm-hmm. You can hear every night down there on 40 meters and 80 meters. And so what we did was, and what we're doing, is on the KPA 1500, we are indexing the fans. There's two things that most new amplifiers do today, and that is we have sensors on the heatsink that can tell the controllers in the amplifiers to speed the fans up at, we call it indexing. And so we can step fans, and in our case of the KPA 1500, we don't just turn the fans on and let them rip. What we're doing is changing the voltage. They're DC fans. And so as the heat sink rises, we start with the center fan, and it spins up first. So as I'm beginning to warm up the amp, the heat sink, that first center fan will start up. And then as the heat sink continues to warm up, the two side fans on either side of it will start indexing up. And so that way we can minimize the amount of fan noise when it's not actually needed. So it's an intelligent controlling system.
And do those tend to go on and stay on as you're transmitting and receiving, or does it tend to follow the whether you are transmitting or not? How much does it switch?
That's based on the duty cycle, the mode you're in. Mm. So let me give you an example. If I'm running CW and I'm a slow code CW guy, and I'm actually a slow code extra myself, I'm not a no code. I'm just a slow code. I'm not going to heat up the amplifier all that much because the duty cycle of the time and the amount of energy in the RF signal that's being amplified is not that bad. Mm. If I'm running in phone mode, I'm probably not going to be running it real hard. However, if I'm running RIDI, it's a high duty cycle mode. It's just like the JT modes are right now, the new digital modes. Most of those guys are high duty cycle modes. That means I'm going to, the percentage of time that the transmitter's running hard is higher than if I'm using phone or CW modes.
So on most on most transceivers, when you're running a data mode, they usually say scale back the output to half of the
correct.
The power. Same thing applies for a PA.
Absolutely. It's scaled up, right? You're generating that much more heat. It's all scaled up. It's linear, right? That's why we call them linears.
Right.
Okay. Right. So let me give you a real time example. I mentioned earlier that I've got guys running moon bounce at 6 meters. Well, they're using high duty cycle modes to do that. And one of the recommendations and things you have to think about in your shack, if you're going to be doing that kind of work, then you're going to be wanting to turn the fans on. And even when I'm not transmitting and generating that heat, I'd like, because it's a small cabinet, I want to have the fan continue to run and not necessarily monitor and use the heat sink temperature as the gauge on how fast it spins, because I'd like to cool it off faster too, right? So there are facilities, our amps have them, the KPA and the 500 and the KPA 1500 have the ability for you to go in and set a menu setting to where the fans will not slow down to a stop. They'll just might come down to half speed because I'm using high duty cycle modes. And that way the fans are still running and getting that heat out of the box while I'm in receive mode.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I would imagine it's like a lot of transceivers. When you're using it a lot and you're transmitting a fair bit, then the fans tend to be on a high speed mode. And if you're, as the temperature goes down, instead of being shut off, they'll go to a slower mode, or maybe like in the case of the 1500, maybe, you know, you pull one or two of them off. You don't necessarily run all three. So what other considerations are there for, like when we talk about environmental considerations, there's power and but you need adequate space around them. So So I look at my K3 and the way I've got my operating position set up, the K3 sits on a little shelf slightly above my desk, and then there's another shelf right above it. So there's not a lot of air circulation around the radio, but I don't run a lot of power and it really never gets warm. So I don't really, it concern me very much. But with these power amplifiers, I got to think you need some space around it for adequate airflow.
Yes. This goes back to that same thing again about the ability to move air in a small cabinet. Not only do we have to be able to move the air through the cabinet, we have to be able to get the air into the cabinet, and then we have to get it away from the cabinet. And so that the environmental consideration is, am I in a cramped quarters where I only have an inch behind my transceiver? Or where should I plan to place these big amplifiers so that they can adequately breathe? That's the fundamental environmental consideration here. It's discussed in the buyer's guide. And so if I have to make a choice, if I constrain the input or the output? And the answer is, don't constrain the output. You want as much space and the least amount of air resistance on the output, wherever that is. And in the case of all Elecraft gear, fans will always exit the back, and the intakes come in from the top.
Okay.
And so you can, so for instance, on our KPA and Cat 500 combo, that's where we have the tuner that's a physically separate box. We actually designed it so that it could sit on top of the KPA 500 and still the KPA can still breathe okay.
However, how does it get airflow if the tuner is sitting on top?
Well, we have feet on the tuner. You got to use our feet. It raises up about a quarter of an inch, and that's good enough given the amount of space all the way around the tuner.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And then
on the back, how much space do you need for adequate airflow on the back?
Minimum of 4 inches. So I can have a quarter of an inch above it, but minimum of 4 inches. The more, the merrier, especially if you're running high-duty cycle modes.
Okay. So we talked about, the voltage, about cooling. Mm-hmm. What about grounding?
Yeah, I was going to say, because the cooling and all that, fine. I get that. We all have electronics. But, you know, we all worry about getting RF back in the shack. And that's one thing when it's 100 watts. But when it's 15x that, like that, again, sounds terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. And it should be treated with respect for that very reason. What I've found working with any number of customers is that when they went from 100 watts and they went out and bought a linear, maybe a 500 watt linear. And then I get a call back. Hey, this thing's tingling and I've got ground fault interrupters that are chattering, all sorts of stuff. I'm going, okay, well, what did you, tell me where your antenna is. Tell me how your grounding is set up. What grounding? I'm going, well, that's first question. Let's get through that one. The key thing is top priority is always to be safe. So grounding and safety are one and the same as far as I'm concerned. In our buyer's guide, I recommend a grounding system called Star Grounding. It's actually discussed extensively in the ARRL book on grounding. Grounding can be mysterious because they show you these diagrams of wires running between your load panel in your house and then the antenna grounds, and it gets all kind of crazy making. But it's important. I can't emphasize enough that safety first. What we don't want to have happen is you touch your gear because there's a AC ground loop somewhere in the house wiring, and all of a sudden you get zapped. I don't want to ever hear that happening. And we have that with the codes, the electrical codes, but your local and state and national electric codes are all designed to make that safe. And as long as we can line up with and know that our shacks meet those codes, we're okay. Okay, so that's that. Now, let's talk about RFI, because that's the other part of you can have it perfectly grounded and still get RFI into your shack. Why? Because we've got enough energy finding its way in some other fashion. So let me give you an example. And this is my own personal example. I here in California, the closer to the water you to the beach that you get, the smaller the lot sizes. And I had a 40-foot by 80-foot lot with a 1,200-square-foot house on it. And I went from 100 watts to 500 watts, KPA 500, brought it into the shack, not thinking that the long wire antenna I'm using, which went right over the top of my 1,200-square-foot single-story house, was, if you measured straight up, it was only about 15 feet. Well, guess what happens when I go from 100 watts to 500 watts? Every time I got to about 350 watts on my KPA 500, all of a sudden it would go off the go into the red. The meter would go in the red, and the amplifier would shut off, would actually fault and take itself out. What it was doing was I was sending enough RF through the long wire, which was going straight through the building and right back into my system, and creating a perfect feedback loop that went totally oscillating.
Oh wow! And probably pretty high voltage by the time you get to the end of that wire.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So all of a sudden now, I'm perfectly grounded. I take great pains with my grounding, but I was perfectly grounded, but yet I'm still having a problem. And I call that the problem of putting it under torque. What I mean by that is, just because your shack has worked fine for the last 20 years at 100 watts, and you walk in the door with a legal limit amplifier, or in my case, even just a 500-watt amplifier, and all of a sudden, I start cranking the power up, and strange things start happening. I actually welded ground fault interrupters shut. Why? Because every time I started talking, you could hear them chattering.
Wow. So where was your antenna in that case?
It was right over the top of the house. It was a long wire going straight over the top of the house. Inverted L. Guess which radiating side is shooting right it back into the shack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You're right in line.
Yeah. I set myself up.
So for the guys if you're putting up a big, 70-foot tower and you're running the coax up to the top of the tower to your beam, you're getting all that RF energy out of the shack. Yep. In that case, you probably don't have nearly as much of an RFI problem.
No, but you can still have RF getting back down if it's not matched well, and you have a lot of RF getting back down the shield of the coax, you can still have that problem.
So a lot of us put up compromise antennas because we don't have a 75-foot tower. We have a tree and a 2x4. we were trying to hack something together, and a lot of times in the last 10 years, I've talked to more guys with NFED wire antennas than I ever talked to in 30 years before then. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's a lot of people using suboptimal non-resonant antennas. And that's just got to be a recipe for trouble.
Well, it is. And it translates back when we're talking about linears. That's that whole issue of putting it under torque. It may work fine at... And even an NFED ZEP might work fine at 100 watts if you assume you have an NFED ZEP that works at that level. There's some other issues with ZEPs in particular. But let's say you have a regular dipole. And at some point, depending on the layout, we've talked about this with mag loops and receive antennas just earlier, right? Where there are ways for RF to creep back into your system. And... at some point, when you start adding more power, things might start going haywire on you because you've never tested the whole shack system under that level of RF torque.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we work at Elecraft, we work with customers, I wouldn't say every day, but we certainly have dealt with some folks with some very complex antenna switching systems that, will exacerbate that, not because you designed it that way, but because it's a byproduct of putting it under torque. And so my suggestion for anybody buying a linear is don't just flip it on first time, crank it up to 1500, you know, and key the transmitter. Start slow. Understand that at some points that you may get strange things happening in the shack for a while until you start ringing them out.
And you may have problems on different bands. Maybe 40 works great, but 20 you've got problems. Or
you got it. And the other thing is that we see in terms of diagnosing, working with customers who've maybe, I bought this linear and it's been working fine for the last 3 or 4 months, and all of a sudden stuff started happening, and they'll call us. And what we'll tend to find is that there's a connection, maybe a current balun or some other thing placed in the transmission line that arcs or overheats. And one of the things you'll find early on with playing around, if you've gone from 100 watts to maybe 5 or 1500 watts, is that at some point you'll start getting some arcing, or maybe a connector, PL259 that is not fully soldered. Maybe some of the braid broke and all of, inside, or water got up into the connector, and boom, all of a sudden at some level on some bands, all hell's going to break loose.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do, recommend a diagnostic trick, is whenever things start breaking loose, the first thing is if you're buying and this is a rule of thumb, I should put it in the buyer's guide. If you've got any linear, I don't care if it's a 200 watt linear, if you don't have a dummy load the same size as that linear, you're not going to be able to diagnose. You're just not going to be able to do it. So, what you do is, if there's unexpected things happening in the shack, particularly if it's related to turning up more power, the first thing is to hook up a dummy load directly to the output of the linear and verify everything's okay. This is a divide and conquer approach. But so then you take that same dummy load and you go to the other end of the transmission line, usually where it heads up the, wherever you've got your connection, maybe for a current balun or any of those kinds of things, and you connect the dummy load out there at the other end and you crank it up again and verify everything, because essentially you're going to have to figure out it's either in the transmission line or it's in the antenna itself that there's a problem, and you have to have a way to be able to divide and conquer.
So you can isolate where your problem really is.
That's right. And I cannot tell you how many guys call us and they're saying, well, my transceiver is not working. And I'm going, okay, talk to me. And we end up finding out that it's something like a bad coax connector somewhere down the transmission line.
Well, and I bet when they were running 50 watts, it didn't stress that connection.
It never did.
And when you're running 500 watts now, you've got a lot more energy, a higher voltage, et cetera, going through that weak connection. Yeah, exactly. That's a great point.
That's the message. Yeah.
So maybe there's kind of an obvious practical piece of advice here that I would take away from a lot of the things you just said, which is that if you're thinking about putting an amplifier in your station, it's not a trivial decision for many reasons, not least of which is you're going to be injecting a lot more RF in the environment. So you better make sure that everything about your station is as well put together as you can. In other words, good quality cables, good quality connectors. Don't have your antenna terribly close to the shack if you can get away with it. Resonant antennas are probably better than non-resonant antennas, et cetera. So the more robust you can make your station, the likelihood of the amplifier working well will be increased a lot. Or flipped around, the odds of getting a lot of RFI and making it a miserable experience will be amplified.
Yes.
Yeah, and of course, and this is one of the areas where part of miserable experience, you just mentioned this briefly, is tingling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Not in a good way.
No. It's that tingle that sort of, you remember when you took the 9-volt battery and put it on your tongue?
Yeah. I mean, even when you mentioned it, I literally felt my fingertips like crawl. Amplifiers are serious business.
That's the message, and we don't take them lightly. For that reason, and it's they're a lot of fun, and they can certainly you know, allow you to turn it up to 11. and those are good. And it, and you know, if there's that one station that'll get you DXCC or maybe, you know, worked all countries or any of those kinds of things, well, sure, you're going to want a linear to be able to achieve those milestones in your hobby. And linears make good sense for those kinds of and rationales for, you know, if you've got the space for all the other stuff. It's just that I don't like to see a guy spending money on a linear when they really didn't need to, you know, because we hadn't hardened the shack or we haven't looked at the rest of things. I want everybody that buys an Elecraft linear to have a positive experience right out of the box.
Do you have any kind of prep guide that you can give to the customer that they could review some tips before they make the purchase and try to install it?
Yeah, I keep referring to the November newsletter. By the way, you can get to that if you go out to the Elecraft.com website, look for the news link at the top of the page. It's right there in a dark gray banner. Look for news, and then you'll see the newsletters listed down the right-hand side. Look for the November newsletter, and it's got a nice little buyer's guide. It's talking a lot about the same stuff. There's also a nice little table of top buying criteria.
Why don't we do a quick break and come back and talk about some of those things to look for when you're buying your amplifier. We'll be right back.
This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Autodesk Eagle PCB Design Tools. All of our projects we're doing on The Workbench use Eagle. It's great for schematic capture and board layout. You can easily generate all of the output files necessary to manufacture a circuit board. And whether you're building one board or 100 boards for your friends, use Eagle Tools because they have really excellent support. They've got a great library of available components. It's widely used amongst the maker and the professional board design tool. You'll enjoy using the tools, and there's a lot of great new features. Check it out at autodesk.com/eagle, and you could download a free copy of the PCB design tool today and get started doing your project.
So, David, you know, we've talked a lot about the considerations for, you know, what an amp does. We've talked about what are the considerations I need to go through in my shack. And so, assuming I've done all the prep work that I need to do from a power perspective, grounding, you know, my feed line and my antenna and all of that stuff is good to go. I have my shiny new amp and I have my radio, but how do I bring the two together? Like, what are the points of interface between the two radios? Is it just a piece of coax? I assume it's more than that.
Yeah, there is actually. And again, this gets back into some of the regulatory requirements we have here in the United States. So linears made and sold in the United States by FCC mandate have to have a separate signal for the communication between the transceiver and the linear that tells the linear when the transceiver goes into transmit. This is called a keying line. Unfortunately, all the other vendors, every vendor uses a different term for it. So, for instance, ICOM calls it SEND, S-E-N-D, or H-SEND. They're not even consistent among themselves. There are other terms in Yaesu and Kenwood vernacular, and again, they don't even are not consistent between models. In Elecraft's vernacular, we called it key out, as opposed to key in, which is where your CW key is. And the objective is to be able to keep the linear synchronized with the transceiver so that it's ready to amplify when you send it RF. That's as simple as that. So there's two basic components that I have to have to connect a transceiver to a linear. That's the RF itself, the coaxial cable between the output of the transceiver to the input of the linear, and then a keying signal that allows the linear to track what the transceiver's doing.
So okay. The keying line is simply the equivalent of like the PTT button, isn't it?
Basically, that's exactly right. And in fact, in the old days, that's what you would do. You would wire up a switch that would when you keyed your mic or your CW key, it would actually trip the linear while you did that at the same time. It's very basic kind of connection mechanisms.
In the case of like the more modern amplifiers, this is like a DC control line to tell the amplifier to go into transmit mode.
Yes, there okay. And there's a convention among the vendors that the linear is the supplier of the DC, and the transceiver merely grounds that line.
Okay.
And it's a common – so anybody who's ever used an Ameritron linear, you probably ended up – depending on the age of your transceiver, you bought a little adapter box called an ARB704. And it's kind of this Play-Doh equivalent of a box that's allowed you to adapt any kind of transceiver to the linears. So there have been these little adapter boxes. You go back into QST, you'll see articles about building those kinds of things as well. Essentially, all you were doing was adapting whatever the transceiver vendor's keying system to a linear. Today, these are pretty common. Most of them run anywhere from about 12 volts down to 5, pretty typical. And all you do is just ground it. So you can actually take a linear keying line and literally short the keying input on the linear. You can actually short it with a screwdriver even, and it'll go and be ready to go into transmit. It will be prepared to amplify if you supply at RF.
Now, earlier you talked about one of the main differences between a tube amplifier and a solid state amplifier is the tube amplifier requires some fiddling in order to get it tuned to what band you're on, maybe even where in the band you are. And so,
that's right.
With a lot of tube amplifiers, I'm assuming that those two lines, the RF line and then the keying line, may be all that you need. Now, if you get into some of the more, I'll call it a hybrid amplifier, because I know it's still tube RF gain stages, but there's a lot of electronics on the front end. Or if we look at the Elecraft amps, where there's a lot of sophistication built in to communicate further with the radio, what are some of those connections, and what are some of the negotiations and data that's being passed around?
Yeah, the cool thing with radios today is that there are a number of conventions for actually controlling a linear more than we did maybe 40 years ago. There you had to band switch, you had to change. If you changed bands on your transceiver, you had to remember to change bands on your linear, otherwise you wouldn't get any RF out, and the transceiver wouldn't like what it saw. And today, particularly with the microprocessor control systems that we have, we now can have linears and their tuners talk with our transceiver in various ways. And so we can break these down into two kind of integration modes. There's one I call basic mode, and then there's another one that I call enhanced mode. So in basic mode, most linears today, those are have been designed the last 5 to 10 years. Most of those linears will have a built-in frequency counter, so that it figures out whenever RF first shows up at the input, it figures out what frequency you're on, even if you switched, told it you were going to 20 meters and then you actually were on 17 meters. It has a frequency counter that'll figure all that out for you. So in basic mode is that that RF line and the keying line added to a frequency counter, so that no matter what I do, that linear will always at the last minute figure out what frequency I really chose, not the one I told it I was going to and then didn't. That's called basic mode. So I have to issue RF from the transceiver to the linear for the linear to figure out what I'm really doing.
Gotcha.
So there's no actual data. It's really just sampling and measuring the actual RF carrier frequency.
Absolutely.
And then
absolutely.
In the case of those, what I call the hybrid amplifier, but I think, and granted, I know nothing about these amps, but I mean, like, if you look at, I think it's ACOM, they're still a tube amp, but they have a lot of like the interactivity in the front end circuitry to probably do some of that tank tuning you were talking about.
Yeah, some of those, they actually have motors and belts and everything in there that are actually doing all that. It actually measures their stepper motors, and it actually knows exactly how many steps it's got to go to get this frequency. They've got this mapping, and it's all run under processors, you know, microprocessors. We call them MCUs or master controllers, but it's basically a processor. So the difference, though, in basic mode and enhanced mode is if I change bands, remember in solid state linears, once you get to a band, you don't have to worry about any more tuning. But it wouldn't it be nice if I had a level of integration between my linear and maybe its tuner or its tuner and the transceiver itself, so that when I change bands on the transceiver, my linear will automatically select the band before I issue the RF. Now, why would that be interesting?
I would assume if it improves your speed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So let's say I'm a DXer, right? And I'm watching the spot. And gosh, look at that. There's that guy that I've been trying to chase for the up on 15 meters, and I'm down on 40, right? Wouldn't it be nice if I could click on that spot and My logging program takes my transceiver to 15 meters, and lo and behold, my linear follows. And as soon as I land on 15 meters, I can key down and make the guy. That gets interesting, right? I mean, that's speed. If I'm a contester, it's the same thing. I can jump from band to band and not have to remember to set up all this stuff. It's just done for me. So we call that enhanced mode. And so there are ways for our linears at Elecraft, we actually support multiple radios, non-Elecraft radios at enhanced modes. And in the article that's in the newsletter, I go into what are the typical ways that Yaesu does this and ICOM and Flex and all that. Now, in addition, though, and I said there's a basic and enhanced mode, but once we get an Elecraft transceiver hooked up to an Elecraft linear and its tuner, we now have an extra level of integration that I call enhanced squared. And so let me give you an example of how that works. So once we have our amplifier talking with, let's say I have a K3S and a KPA500 and its companion CAT500 tuner. Now, the radio knows when I go between online and offline with my linear. All linears have a switch that basically says, I want you to run barefoot and don't ever amplify no matter what I do. And then I have an online button with it that says, okay, I'm going to switch you in line. Wouldn't it be nice if the transceiver knew that when I do that, it can back down to a drive level automatically, so I don't have to stop and remember, oh yeah, I just turned the linear on, now I got to back off my drive level on my transceiver. And we have that capability with Elecraft gear once you've got all of it wired together. And so there's another feature that's really cool, where the automatic antenna tuner can read the VFO frequency of the transceiver. Now, what that means then is that if I've trained my automatic tuner to where it already knows what tuning elements, the L's and C's that it needs to provide the proper tuning and matching, wouldn't it be neat if it could read the transceiver VFO and then pre-select those before I ever key down? So that's what we call enhanced squared.
Now, is something like that only going to work with an Elecraft transceiver or...
Right.
Or can that get the same data from like a Yaesu or an ICON?
Well, it can to some degree, but most of the time the answer is no. Particularly, essentially what we do is build our systems, our radio, so that, and this is really applicable, by the way, to the K-line. That's the K3S, KPA 1500 or 500, and the CAT 500 and all that. It really becomes either a 500-watt or a 1500-watt transceiver. It's in physically separate cabinets, mm-hmm. but it's acting as a big, fat transceiver.
Okay, so this is like the first big click in my mind about like what's the value of getting it all from one vendor. So yes. So you can So correct me if I'm wrong, David. So you can say buy an ICOM transceiver and an Elecraft amplifier, hook them up, and it'll work fine. And it'll probably work fine like it would have worked 20 years ago. But there's probably, due to the ability of the single vendor to control all of the interfacing between the two things, you could have a more seamless system. And maybe the seamless nature of it is, well, maybe like you were saying, Jeremy, the switching might be faster, or there's no tuning, or I don't know. There's something about it that just makes it that much more convenient and easy to use and less to hassle with.
That's correct. Now, there's one other advantage by having that level of integration, and that is if I'm thinking about building a remote system.
Yeah.
Right?
My remote system.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, you said you were, you have to go out and because you're running QRP and you just don't have a lot of operating options there, right, and your QTH. So what if you had your system up on a mountaintop somewhere else that you could fly the bird from your small shack, or maybe you got a condo or an apartment? And wouldn't it be nice then if you didn't have to remember to worry about all this stuff because the thing is so well integrated that all you do is just fly it?
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Yeah. So that's actually one of the operating requirements that we put on the KPA 1500, that it had to not only fully operate in with a full seamless integration like we have with the KPA 500 now, but we also have to make the linears so that they can recover from faults remotely. You're not going to necessarily be sitting in the shack to be able to throw that switch anymore. And so we've engineered those kinds of features in as well.
So when you say recover from fault, so this is interesting. So what kind of fault condition could you get yourself into that you could then manage yourself out of?
Okay. So so all of our amplifiers and a lot of the new ones, this is not just Elecraft, because we talked earlier about instrumenting the linears, that is, there's all kinds of meters that are and instrumentation fingers that we've put into the circuits so that, let me give you an example, on the KPA 500 right now, and in the same way on the 1500, we measure, whenever you're transmitting, we are measuring input power, we're measuring output power, we're measuring returned power, that's reflected power, and we're measuring the current through the finals, all at the same time. And we have what we call a little box, if you can imagine a box, and we call it the safe swimming area. If any one of those operating parameters gets outside the safe swimming area, there is damage potential for the amplifier, and the amplifier is smart enough to know that, and it will take steps to protect itself.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Same way happens with the tuner. The tuner is measuring input power. It's measuring SWR. And if, for instance, on the CAT 500, it'll be the same way with the 1500. If there's a radical change in SWR, I can configure the tuner to step in and take action. And one of those actions is to disable the linear. Why would I allow the tuner, if the tuner knows there's a problem somewhere down the transmission line, why would I let that tuner allow the linear to pump power into it?
Oh, so this is like an automatic interlock in a sense.
There are safety conditions based on what we call the safe swimming area, right? That's that. And as long as I stay inside the buoys, I can swim safely because I got lifeguards. But if I go outside of that, I'm in danger, right? So think of the same thing with linears and tuners. And we've got the smarts as long as we've got the instrumentation. And so one of the items in the buying guide is, if you're evaluating linears, ask about how much instrumentation it's got and what that does and how it's going to protect itself.
Okay, so when you say instrumentation, two things pop into my mind. One thing is that there is built into the amplifier a processor that is reading a bunch of sensors and making some decisions based on what it's reading. So
that's exactly right.
gee, the PA is too hot, I'm going to throttle back the output power or whatever, you know.
Or so I raise the fans and stuff like that, yeah.
Exactly. So there's a lot of sensors and a lot of, like, closed-loop control stuff going on. But the other thing that pops into my mind as you were describing that is can you use any of that stuff for remote diagnostics? So let's say my amplifier is acting weird for some reason, and I call you up and say, David, my amplifier is acting weird. It'd be great. I mean, I have internet. The amplifier is probably sophisticated enough to have its own Ethernet connector, perhaps. Can you just, like, jack in and you guys can remotely probe around inside the amplifier and see what's going on?
Yeah, we're actually working in that direction. So the KPA 1500 already has a Cat5 connector on the back. There'll be some rudimentary remote controls at first customer release shipments, but you should expect to see more firmware releases where we'll be adding features along those lines.
Right, so that's pretty cool. So, David, one of the things that strikes me about this instrumentation topic, as you talk about it, is it seems like there's two ways to look at this. One is you have microcontrollers inside the amplifiers that are sensing various conditions and adjusting the operating of the device.
Yep, there's two aspects. There's one where it's a protective thought. So it's that safe swimming area, right? Are we in or out of the safe swimming area? So that's one part. The other part is that communication, that interface stuff that we're talking about, because it takes a lot of smarts to know all that stuff too.
So it seems like maybe future direction for some of the high-end radios or amplifiers or accessories is to enable remote diagnostics or remote service. So if I had some weird behavior in my station, I would love to be able to call Elecraft and say, hey, could you guys log into my station and take a look?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I got to box it up and ship it to you, and you got to bench it and futz around, where you could probably get half of the problem figured out just by looking at the settings or the measurements of various things inside the radio or amplifier.
We can do that today. Every one of our linears has a fault log, and it has of course, it has its own tuner memories. And I can tell you that because of that instrumentation, and whenever some sort of we actually have two kinds of faults. They're called soft faults and hard faults. Hard faults are ones that are you're way outside the safe swimming area. The amplifier and the tuner is going to it's basically going to turn a little red light on and then just get out of the way because it's unsafe. That's hard faults. There's soft faults where, you remember what I said, as you get close to 1.8 to 1, then solid state amps don't start liking you very much because there's a lot of, they don't work well without a tuner matching, keeping it down. Well, at soft faults are where we're logging event information, but we're not shutting off the linear's transmit capabilities yet. It's transmitting. It's not liking what it sees, but it's right up on the edge of the safe swimming area, but it's logging faults. It's logging information that we can then go in and diagnose.
Oh, interesting. So do you do that with other products or just the amplifiers?
It's the high power stuff.
Oh, okay.
The high power tuners, high power. So all of our linears, even the 100 watt amp, that the KXPA 100, it's got a fault log. It's got tuner memories. It's got a configuration information. You can save that information as a config file. You can email it to Elecraft support, and we can actually take that apart and then give you a report back and tell you how many memories you got, where they are, which ones were successful. I can tell you what kind of faults I was seeing. And generally, we've gotten so good at this, we can pretty well tell you what kind of antennas you have just by looking at what – it's amazing how much instrumentation can give us like that.
That's great. Well, yeah, I would really think cool. That's very helpful for your own service department if they're going to go try to figure out what's wrong.
Well,
that probably gives them a lot of insight.
And it also tells us about how to go about diagnosing and remedying the problem without the, without a unit being shipped back.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you're in a remote situation, that means you got to drive out to the remote site, get the gear, and ship it back. What if we could be able to do all that so that you don't have to do all those kinds of things? That gets interesting. Yeah. That's what, and this instrumentation is the core part of that.
Hmm.
And so we engineer that into all of our high-powered linear products and tuners, too. The Cat 500, the tuner inside, the KPA 1500 is going to have it as well. Yeah.
Well, that's very cool. So when you think about, let's say, a ham who says, all right, I really want to buy an amplifier. What are the tips you'd give him? Besides, I mean, we talked about a lot of stuff already, but if you kind of boiled it down to some basic buying advice, how would you approach it? So if I came to you, you know, today and said, David, I'm going to buy an amplifier, but I don't know what to get. What where would you point me?
Yeah. So I'd ask you, there's kind of like maybe about five or six different categories I'd go after. So let me kind of step through those real quick and see how this works. First one is that you remember the discussion about basic and enhanced mode. To what degree can I interface the linear with my transceiver? Is it basic mode or is it enhanced mode? How would that work? And so that's the question about how much futzing do I have to do with the linear once I get it connected up as I change bands? Okay, that's number one. Number two, is there an auto tuner that has the same level of integration as the linear itself? Okay, because the tuners and the linears have to work hand in hand, and if they if you've got one vendor for the tuner, one vendor for the linear, and another vendor for the transceiver, is that going to work?
So it may not be, is it going to work, yes or no, but it could be how much manual intervention is required versus how seamless is the operation. Because, you know, a lot of us, what we would love to do is look at the Elecraft webpage and go, yeah, I'll just take one of everything. But, you know, that may not be in our budget. So, so one of the trade-offs might be, okay, am I optimizing for the best possible integrated user experience for which I will pay more money? Or I may hodgepodge a little bit and, okay, I'm going to use my old radio and then buy a nice amplifier. And it may not be the perfect fit, but it'll work.
Yeah, as long as you've got a long-term strategy about why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me get back to the buying criteria and hold that thought, because I deal with that every day with customers as well. So besides the that auto band switching and the basic and enhanced mode, do you have the tuner that can also work the same way? The third buying criteria is, how is the linear switched when it goes between transmit and receive? In other words, because if the linear and the old tube amps, you can still buy linears today, but they have relays that you have to, that will switch the linear between transmit and receive. Well, if I've got a transceiver that, and more of the new transceivers are not using relays anymore. They're using what are called PIN diodes we call them TR diodes, transmit receive diodes. It automatically switches the radio between the two without having these relays with lots of fingers that get corroded and stuff. Relays are slow. So if I'm working up my speed as a high speed operator, CW-wise, you know, so if I'm, you know, as you're at some point, you're going to outrun your relays in your linear.
Well, okay. Let me ask you a quick side question.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of these linears run a real break-in QSK operation?
Yes, they can. Yes, they can now. With transmit receive diodes installed, yes, they can do that. As long with relays, it was much harder. At some point, you could not do that anymore, because the sheer switching time and settling time of relays limited your ability to go between transmit and receive time-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. We've tested a K3S and a KPA 500 up to 100 words a minute.
Oh, my gosh.
So
one of the things that I've come to appreciate about my K3, here's my plug for Elecraft. from the very beginning, I'm with you. I'm a slow speed extra.
Yeah. Yeah. So slow code.
I love CW, but it doesn't love me back. But you know, with my K3, I was operating CW, and it works great. And then I went and used a friend's different brand radio, a very nice radio, almost about the same price, and it had a TR relay in the circuit.
Yeah, you noticed it.
It didn't even occur to me that that radio would have a TR relay. And I started sending CW, and it's like a landline Morse telegraphy session. Because every time I'm sending a did or a dot, it's like clicking. And I'm thinking, no, this can't be right. What's it doing? It shouldn't be clicking on every dit. And the only way you could really use that radio is in like a semi break-in mode.
That's correct.
And I was just kind of shocked because I got so spoiled with the instantaneous TR switching on the K3.
Yeah, and that's why this is in the buying criteria for a linear.
If you're a CW contest or DXer, then that pin diode switching makes a huge difference.
It's a no-brainer. Yeah, it's a no-brainer. Yeah. Okay, so that's number three. Number four. We just got through talking about this. Fully instrumented to protect the gear if antenna systems fail. Mm. Why would I want to be pumping 1,500 watts and it just so happens that half of my dipole fell down? Wouldn't it be nice if the system is smart enough to recognize that the SWR just changed catastrophically and maybe I should do something about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's number four. Fully instrumented system in the linear and its companion tuner to know when it's outside the safe swimming area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's number four. Number five, we talked about logging the faults. So if all this started happening, wouldn't it be nice if it left some audit trail, some trail in the system, in the amplifier, so that we could go back and figure out what the heck just happened?
Mm-hmm.
So logging of faults to figure out what might have gone wrong. And then lastly, remote diagnostic and recovery facilities. How can we, what kind of ways can we get the data, all that data, that fault log and all that stuff out of the linear? Do I have to go unnatural acts to do it? Can I just hook up a Cat5? Maybe I got to connect an RS-232 connection or whatever, but at least how do I know I can get it out of the box?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, can it be extracted, or do I have to literally read it off the front panel? And there are some linears where you still have to do that. More of your new linears, though, are giving you good facilities for getting that data, that diagnostic data out.
Gotcha.
So there's your kind of top buying criteria.
So probably at least half of the things you mentioned, if I went back and looked at a top-notch station 20, 30 years ago, those features weren't even there.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Because I'm thinking about, back in like in the late 70s, mm-hmm. a pretty hot station would have been like, well, Collins or Kenwood or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. radio with like a Henry amplifier.
Yeah.
And, you know, big tube amplifier with a big iMac, you know, whatever, 4CX, mm-hmm. something or other. And those were, at the time, like, those were the bee's knees, man. They were great.
Absolutely. But you had to be present and accounted for to be able to fly the bird, right?
You have to be very present. Because there's some serious voltage happening there.
You got it. You got heat, so, voltage, everything, yeah.
So actually, if you fast forward to today, my takeaway from all that is you could still have that traditional experience, let's say, today at probably a more modest price. So when you look at the market, I've seen amplifiers like 600-watt amplifier, 500-watt amplifier for maybe as little as $700,
$800. Sure. Sure.
And then I've seen others for $2,000-$3,000, and it's not just the logo. There's something different. So
it sure is.
Mm-hmm. Is a lot of what's different what you just rattled off through those different criteria?
Yes, that's exactly right. You can buy the same design. I mean, literally the same circuit topologies, the same tank circuits, and everything that was available 40 years ago. You can buy them right now
with a bunch of 811s or.
811s in there, you can buy it, you can get them, and they are just as operator intensive as they were 40 years ago.
Now, in all fairness, if you're a ham on a budget, if I came to you and said, look, I don't have $3,000 to spend on an amplifier, I can barely squeeze out $700. Would it still be worth getting an amplifier like what we just discussed, a fairly manually operated amplifier?
You can. It's a great learning curve because you got to crawl. If you look at the crawl before you walk kind of approach, sure, because that's how we used to do it in the old days. And if that's okay for you, for instance, if I'm a rag chewer, that's probably going to be okay, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm not going to be, I'm probably going to park myself on one of the frequencies and hang out for a while. And now if the DX bug or if the contester bug bites me, you'll be handicapped with one of those lesser expensive amplifiers.
And even if you're not trying to be the number one in your category in the contest,
yeah.
I would think the operating experience would be tedious, to say the least.
That's exactly right. And you're going to be mistake prone. In other words, that's right. I forgot to tune the tank circuit. Oh, I forgot to switch the linear. I changed bands on the transceiver, right? So those, that basic mode stuff, mm-hmm. The really dumb versions of those, you're going to make all those same mistakes I made in 1979.
Well, when I had my TS-520, I had to dip the plate and peak the loader, you had to do all that stuff anyway. But, as soon as the solid state radios came out, it was pretty obvious. Why would you mess with that if you didn't have to? For that matter, like just look at tuners. Back in that generation, you had a big, big coil and a couple of capacitors. And every time you move 20, 30 kilohertz, you're like peaking it again. And today we're very spoiled because, we QSY and the radio goes, okay, and retunes. And you just don't even think about it.
That's exactly right. And the other thing about those old tuners was that you would arc them up. You remember those old big roller inductors? Mm-hmm. At some point, they'd start arcing and burn. You remember those? Remember those days? That's outside the safe swimming area. And that tuner and that linear would just keep right on pumping the power into it. Right?
That's right. They were robust.
Brute force. Yeah.
Yep.
So those are the things, those value adds are the kinds of things that we're seeing that are new in the market in the last 5 to 10 years.
Isn't that just like almost any technology where if you think about, how automobiles 20, 30 years ago were, the most electronics in a car was like the radio.
Yeah.
And today, if you look at a brand new car, there's probably 30% of the value of the vehicle or more is in the electronics and getting more complicated by the day. But the expectation in the consumer's mind is that, well, of course I should have, windshield wipers that detect the moisture and mm-hmm. turn themselves on. Why would I flip the switch? So our expectation has sort of changed as the technology's advanced.
And I will tell you that the new features are not going to be in the hardware in the new linears. They're going to be in the firmware.
Mm-hmm.
Over time.
The actual component count for most of the amplifier, the actual amplifier circuit is pretty simple.
It is in the core signal circuit, but the control circuits are different animals. Yeah,
exactly. So I bet if you look at the total engineering time, I bet there's a significant amount of time spent on the firmware.
Yes, and that will increase. That will increase over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start looking into the future for linears, we should expect to see more instrumentation, more remote control, smarter, the ability to protect itself without getting into trouble. That's that safe swimming area thing coming back again. Those are the areas where we're going to have, and that all adds up to more cool features, more integration with transceivers.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not the same brand, you're going to see a lot more integration there. and so there's a lot of value, exciting value for the linear over and above just its core function of amplifying by 15 dB as we got through, started talking about some time back.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's pretty exciting. It's interesting to see that a device in the shack, which is essentially a simple idea, can in this day be actually be fairly complex, but make the user's experience easier.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it is. Yeah, that is the trend, and there's no reason to believe it's not going to continue.
Well, David, I really want to thank you for coming on. This has been really fun and educational for us. And I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. This is, by the way, again, I want to mention that the buyer's guide's out in the November newsletter. You can sign up for our newsletter, too, while you're over at the same site. The other thing I'd suggest is if you've got any questions about some of the stuff we talked about here, certainly get back with George and Jeremy. But you can also contact Elecraft directly. Email is support@elecraft.com. It doesn't make any difference if you have bought anything. You do not have to have purchased something from Elecraft to ask us a question, particularly if it's related to some of the topics that we talked about tonight. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. You can also look, of course, at our products on our website. But if you've got any technical questions, we don't differentiate between sales, pre-sales, and post-sales. It's all customer support for us.
Well, and I'll add, too, here that you guys really do have an outstanding reputation for customer support. And I'm not saying that because you guys are a sponsor on the show, but just read any of the Elecraft mailing lists, any of the email lists. It's just, you know, very well understood that you guys do a super duper job on customer support.
Yep. Yep. That's exactly right. We work hard at that, believe me.
I bet you guys do. But, you know, knowing Eric and Wayne, and those guys are pretty demanding, and I think they would want nothing less. So, not surprising, but it's great to see that.
Yeah, it's built into the value system at Elecraft. It's that core.
I was going to say, really the testament. I mean, a couple of things. I don't know that we've ever publicly said this, but when we look for partners, we wouldn't bring anybody on, right? I mean, Elecraft for us is much here because we are fully bought into the way they do things, the way they do business, as anything. And the fact that I bought my KX3 and gosh, how long ago did that come out? 5 years? Something like that?
Yep. Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. Yep. And I'm still getting firmware updates.
That's correct.
I mean, it's not a product that's only getting updated when there's a critical issue. These products are still under constant active development. And along the way, so many features have been added from, you know, like I remember when voice keying voice keying may be the wrong word, but where you could record, like calling CQ. I remember when that was added as a feature for free. I remember when one day we all woke up and surprise, have 15 watts.
Yes, that was a great surprise.
That's right.
You know,
well, wasn't that cool?
there's not very many places where you can have a dialogue through the email list with the founders of the company and the guys who are intimately involved in doing product development. So, and I know that's got to be an enormous time sink for your guys to do that, David. But I think it really speaks volumes for the company and its commitment to their customers.
That's its intent. If you look at it from a kind of a theoretical standpoint, any time that an engineering team gets so involved that it forgets about its customers and doesn't have contact with them, then you're going to get a product that comes to market that doesn't solve a customer's problem. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can talk to the engineers directly, interact with them on the Elecraft email reflector is a good thing for both the engineering teams at Elecraft as well as for the customers too.
Well, and I think it's reasons like that that Elecraft has really had quite a following. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of us fanboys here for Elecraft for good reason. I mean, I got to tell you one quick aside. I know we're wrapping up here, but I got to tell you one little story. The first Elecraft radio that I had any contact with was a K2. And I was one of the first 100 builders of the whatever that was called, the prototype run of the K2. And the inside the radio, all of the relays were latching relays. So the antenna tuner, when it went into its connected you know, whatever position in various L's and C's used latching relays. And I thought, okay, these guys totally get it. This is the first time I ever saw that. No other antenna tuner or radio I had ever seen did that. And it's so obviously a good idea, especially if you're fanatical about power consumption, as a lot of us QRP nuts are. And I thought, wow, these guys are really doing it right. And the attention to detail is awesome. So anyway, it was just a little data point, but that really sort of cemented in my mind, like, oh, this is really great. And haven't been disappointed since.
Yeah, well, the whole company works hard to make sure that we stay customer focused, because at the end of the day, that's how we'll deliver products that you value.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, thanks again so much for coming on. I hope
My
we can
pleasure.
Get you on again soon. This has really been fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Thank you so much, and again, thank you for having us on. And I'm just thrilled to have been able to spend the time with you.
Well, thank you very much, and we certainly look forward to bringing you guys back for more exciting topics in the future. In the meantime, speaking of topics, if you have feedback or topics or interest or want to appear on the show, feel free to send us an email to workbench@hamradio360.com. You can also follow me online on Twitter at KF7IJZ.
And I'm at KJ6VU.
Thank you, as always, for listening. We really appreciate it. Thank you for all your support. As we wrap up here, coming into the end of the year, we have a lot of things, I guess we'll say, on the burners planned for 2018, and we're excited. But of course, as always, we would not or could not be doing this without you, our listeners. So thank you very much for that. And until next time, 73.
73s.
73.
Over to you, old man.
Am I supposed to stop?
No, it's fine.
Sometimes this is where eye contact would be useful. And time for a break. Doggy needs to go outside. Please take a moment to grab a refreshment, use the potty, whatever you need to do. We'll be back.
How's this feel? Yes? How's this going?
Another 3 minutes of content in the can. So it's looking good to me. My dog is turning into a crotchety old man.
You should get him a call sign. He can get on 80 meters.
Yeah, he should be.
K9 DOG.
Yes. No, just K9. He's that old.